We will call this committee meeting to order. This is Monday, March 16th, 2015, the hearing of the Transportation and Public Safety Committee. Senator Stump, you're the first one in the room, so you get to go up first. Senate File 1041, non-domiciled commercial driver's learner permit or non-domiciled commercial driver's license issue.
All right. Thank you,
Senator Stump.
Mr. Chairman and committee members. This is a bill that was brought to me by the wheat growers, and I believe it would be certainly something that we'd try to consider. What it really pertains to is allowing drivers who are licensed but who are not domiciled to allow them to drive as they work and do some of the harvesting on these harvest crews. And Mr. Clavin, who represents the wheat growers and some other commodity groups, is here to kind of explain why we should do it.
Great. Thank you. Welcome, Mr. Clavin. Please introduce yourself.
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, Bruce Clavin. I work for the Minnesota Association of Wheat Growers. The bill in front of you this morning, or this afternoon, is a result of an email chain we had last summer between our association, DPS, and the feds. This bill, I should tell you up front, is not about the conversation about illegals having driver's licenses, a DREAM Act, border security, immigration, or anything. This is something that has been happening and going on for a long time. It's really a federal conformity bill because the feds changed one of their procedures and definitions back in 2011. And if states don't make this change, we'll be out of compliance with the feds. And according to the federal director here in the state, Dan Drexler, we could risk some federal funds. It has not been an issue until now because of this 2011 federal change, and that's why we're bringing it today. And the reason the wheat growers are interested in this has to do with the custom harvesting operations that happen. Oftentimes what will happen is a crew will come up from Texas. They start in June when the wheat is ripe down there, and as the wheat ripens, as they go north, they wind up in Minnesota at the end of July and into August. And a typical crew will have 3, 4, or 5 combines, a couple of trucks, and a camper or two for the crews to live in as they move through during the summer. It's not really a family-friendly exercise unless you're the family that owns the company. Otherwise, you sit in a combine for 12 or 14 hours a day, and that's pretty much all you do. Some of the folks that operate the machinery run the combines. Others run the trucks. And some of those folks are from other countries, and they're doing this for a summer job. So that's why we have an interest in it. Farmers are generally exempt from CDLs, the commercial driver's licenses. But because this is a for-hire operation, and because it goes through multiple states, the drivers of the trucks have to get the full CDL that the over-the-road trucks would have. So that's why it's an issue for them. Email chain that got us here, just some excerpts quickly to understand. One of our members wrote to Department of Public Safety, Ms. McCormick, on July 30th, simply asking, is Minnesota going to recognize this federal change that took place in 2011? She writes back, you would need to go to Dan Drexler, who is the federal contact here in the state. It's a federal issue, so she deferred to him. We write to him, and he says, Minnesota does not currently have a system for the non-domiciled individual from a foreign country under the Code of Federal Regulations. So since we don't have it, he's saying we would need to adopt it in order to be in compliance. And this was on August 4th. There was a follow-up question, and on August 5th he said, Minnesota may, but is not required, to issue the non-domiciled CDL. And to my knowledge, Minnesota does not have a program. It requires someone to be in the country legally, and that's stamped on the license. The two changes that were made in 2011 was they changed non-resident to be non-domiciled, and the second thing was that they required stronger proof of the time the person was spending in the country, and that was on August 5th. So we proceed under the understanding that we need to make a change to state law. We have an annual meeting in December. We have a resolutions process. We pursue the bill. We jacket it up, find a couple authors, and here we are today. In the meantime, I contacted Ms. McCormick when the session started a couple weeks ago, asked her where the department was, and her response was that Minnesota does provide CDLs to foreign workers, And the date on the card is something on the license that they might be changing in the next year when their contract is up. So her view was that we are doing it, and this is not needed. And we talked on the phone about that. So we're not sure who's right, if the department is right or if the feds are right. But our concern is we don't want to leave here with the taillights on May 19th and find out this summer that there was a problem. And so talking to your committee administrator, we decided to hear it today. I thank her for working with me on that publicly. This may end up to be belt and suspenders at the end of the day, but we understood we needed to have this, and that's why we brought the bill.
It's like sounds like there is no harm if we pass this. Questions, members? Oh, I'm sorry, Senator Kiffmeyer.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think you answered my question, but I'm not familiar with this, so I was just going to ask for clarification what domiciled in a foreign jurisdiction or more context, but I think you gave that context already. But if you want to clarify any further, I'd appreciate it.
Sure.
Mr. Clavin.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Kiffmeyer. Yeah, the person who gets the CDL, their residency is in another country. They are here typically under an H-2A visa, which is one of the ag allowances into the country to do ag work. So it's for a definite period of time, and as I understand it, that date is stamped on the license.
Okay. All right. All right, any other further questions, members? So Senators.
Chairman?
Oh, Senator Stump.
Mr. Chairman, shortly before the hearing, we received that there is a fiscal note on this particular bill.
So, yeah, it's a small fiscal note, but that will route us through finance. I don't completely understand it. Mr. Boyd, do you want to explain it briefly, even though we're in a policy committee?
Yep.
Sure.
Mr. Chair and members, the fiscal note relates to the change mandated on the licenses to stamp them as non-domicile commercial driver's license or non-domicile commercial learner's permit, that this will require a change with the DPS's vendor and will cost a one-time $65,000 for the change.
Thank you. I have questions about that, but we'll figure it out in finance. All right. Any other questions, members? So we should have a greater Minnesota person make the motion. This is an ag matter. So Senator Peterson moves that Senate File 1041 be recommended to pass and referred to the Committee on Finance. All in favor? Oh, would anyone else like to testify on Senate File 1041? All right. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed, no. Motion carried. Oh, sorry, was there?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and committee members.
Thank you, members.
Thank you, Senator Stump. So where do we go now? Back to rest? All right, Senator Rest. Thank you. Oh, should I do? Here. I'm sure. Senator Rest, welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senate File 1466 is an agency bill for deed, and I believe that there is even yet a technical correction, or did that get that was suggested by Ms. McCormick, did that get taken care of? I mean, that we don't need it, or do we need to change a reference?
Ms. Berzovsky.
Mr. Chair and Senator Rest, Ms. McCormick informed me an hour or so ago that it was resolved and that no amendment was needed.
Okay, thank you very much. Glad to hear that. What the bill does is to allow the exchange of driver's license information from the Department of Public Safety to DEED in order to carry out its required duty. So that is Article 1, Section 1. Article 2 is just expanding a little bit on the activities of DEED, and then Article 3 also has to do with information, but it's unemployment information. There's a report that's released the end of February, but shortly before the February forecast that uses information from the unemployment statistics, but the information at that time is not public, even though it is available to MMB. And so what the bill does is just to reinforce what the current practice is, which is to use that information by MMB. And we have an expert here from the Department of Economic Development to answer any questions if the committee feels it needs further information.
All right.
He doesn't need to testify, but if you have questions, well, we'd be happy to have him respond.
Great. Thank you, Senator Rest. Questions, members? Senator Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Senator Rest. Do we have a testifier first, Mr. Chairman? I didn't want to.
Oh, this is a gentleman from the Department of Employment and Economic Development who is here to respond to questions.
Okay. Yeah. All right. I just wanted to be sure I didn't get
Thank
ahead
you.
Of a
I appreciate
testifier.
That.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senator Rest, I have, in reading the analysis here by our staff, that this information would include the photograph and the Social Security number, the driver identification number. What would be the purpose of those three pieces of information to do, labor market demographic analysis? Why would you need a photo, a Social Security number, or even the driver's identification number?
Mr. Chairman, that information is required in order to fulfill the requirement of doing the report. But I can let the testifier speak more to that. But they do need it in order to do what they're required to do by law. So it's not phishing. It is something. It's information that they need.
Go ahead.
Welcome. Please introduce yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Senator, members of the committee. My name is Steve Hine. I'm Research Director at DEET, and as such, I'm responsible for labor market information, including demographic information. Let me first describe how we would make this exchange, and perhaps that will answer your question, Senator. What we strive to do with this bill is to develop a way of identifying in our employment wage records the date of birth and the gender of each individual in that comprehensive data set. The way we have proposed and the way DPS has agreed to facilitate this exchange is that we would send them a list of the Social Security numbers in our employee records that we wish to identify in the driver's license data. We would also attach to that file an anonymous, unique identifier to each of those Social Security numbers. We would pass that to DPS through a secure environment. They would then match that set of Social Security numbers against their records, and for anything that matches, they would pull the date of birth and the gender for that individual, and then they would return to us the date of birth, the gender, and that unique anonymous ID code. Once we receive that, then we would be able to match that against our records, append the date of birth and gender to our employment records, and that would be the end of it. At that point, date of birth and gender would be treated along with all of the other data elements, like an individual's wages, okay, and we would treat that data just as we do all of the other information in those employee wage records. So we are not receiving any Social Security numbers. I don't know. We certainly don't want pictures, if I understood that question right. All we're asking for is the ability to attach the date of birth so that we can determine a person's age. We'll be able to, from that information, identify regions or industries or what have you in the state that are likely to be impacted by the rising retirements that we're experiencing, that we will experience over the next few years. And of course, with the gender, be able to discern any gender differences in employment outcomes.
Senator Kiffmeyer.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Well, the bill doesn't narrow it to date of birth and gender. It is broad. It authorizes, matter of fact, it says shall disclose personal information as defined in U.S. code and so on, which in the analysis that we have here defines what that is. So the bill itself and the language is more broad than what you're saying here, okay?
Yeah.
So I have a concern about that, and that may need to be go through. I just have a concern in general about being careful about the DVS we've had in the past little while, breaches of this data with DVS, and it's been a very great cause of concern. So now here we are opening into another port of moving and comparison and stuff. And I don't know that this is really necessary for our labor market demographic analysis, but even if it were determined, I still think this is way broader than what I'm hearing you talk about your intended use.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Ress.
I do have U.S. Code 2721. With me here, and the permissible uses do include, and I'll just read it,
Mr. Chair, Senator DPS. Ress, could you get closer to the microphone?
Yes, I will. This is a terrible room for this. The information that is in driver's license information, permissible use of it is for use by any government agency, including any court or law enforcement agency, in carrying out its functions. And the department is required to do these reports. And in order to do these reports, it needs that additional information of gender and date of birth, in addition to the data that it already gets with regard to or has on hand wages, et cetera, et cetera. These are just two more pieces of information, but they're coming from DPS rather than any other resource within state government. So it's the U.S. Code permits it, explicitly permits it, and that's what the department is asking for in order to carry out analysis that it's required to do. It's not something they're dreaming up. They're required to do it, and they need this information in order to give us accurate analyses.
So, Senator Ress, how do we respond to the concerns of Senator Kiffmeyer around making sure the data remains secure and confidential?
Well, Mr. Chairman, I think Mr. Hine explained the process by which that they go through in order to have all the information come to them blind. There are no they don't get Social Security numbers.
Right.
They get an anonymous identifier.
Right.
That is then associated with a birth date and a gender, but it is not cannot be traced back to any individual.
Great. Excellent. Thank you. Any further questions? Senator Peterson.
Mr. Chairman.
Sorry, Senator Kiffmeyer.
Thank you. Well, I just have as soon as you use the word phrase, anonymous unique identifier, it's conflicting with each other. It can't be anonymous if it's a unique identifier. And so that doesn't fit. And without question, matter of fact, most of the time, the purpose of the unique identifier is to be able to make sure that you have linked to independent records to make sure you have accuracy there. But to make it anonymous is not an accurate description of it. And matter of fact, nigh on to impossible to even make that premise.
Mr. Chairman,
Senator Ress.
There is a firewall. The Social Security number is the individual identifier. the department will not get that information back from the Department of Public Safety. It is assigned a random number that is put with the birthday and the gender, and although it is individual data, it is not identified. And so in that regard, that's why I called it anonymous. And Mr. Hine can correct me if I, in my non-economist
thank you
presentation.
Mr. Hine.
Mr. Chair.
Misstated it.
Absolutely, our need is to then reattach that date of birth and gender to the proper employee record, all right, which we would be able to do then through the crosswalk between that unique identifier and the Social Security number. Then that those would be two additional data elements on an employee record that would be treated in the sense of security and confidentiality protections, just as all of the other information that is used in those employee records, which we have had a long and successful history of maintaining securely.
Senator Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Rest, in reviewing Article 2, it appears in the underlined sections there in 2.24, the information is going to be used including solicitations and proposals for programs. And I just wanted to see how important that section is to you, because I'm just not sure, you know, that Minnesotans are going to appreciate us turning on this data over to Deed for the purpose of them being solicited for something in the future. Is that?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Peterson, the reason why these are not in sequence is that they are separate articles dealing with separate subjects. Article 2 does not have anything to do with data sharing.
Right. Okay. Okay. Anything further, members? Senator Pratt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A couple of years ago, we talked about driver's license data being used for voting. And we were told that not everyone had a license or an ID. And so it seems to me that there's a gap in your analysis relying on that data to do some of this analysis. And how would you cover that gap? Because I'm presuming that a number of those folks, as we heard a couple, you know, in 2012, would probably have a higher percentage of being unemployed, retired, et cetera.
Mr. Hine. Chair, Senator, you're absolutely right. And one of the things that I need to find out is exactly what our success rate is. Now, we don't necessarily need to get to 100% in order to be able to say a great deal more than we're currently able to say about, again, where those waves of retirement may have the most impact in our state, where gender-based balances may not align. In other states that have undertaken exactly the same sort of exercise here, the success rate here has been in the 90 to 95% range. And I'm hopeful that we'll be able to achieve that and that there won't be too many distortions left in the data with that missing 5%. But that is one of the great unknowns right now. Until we do this, we don't know how successful and at what rate we'll be able to match date of birth with the employee records. I'm hopeful that it's 19 out of 20.
All right. Anything further, committee?
Mr. Chair.
Senator Westrom. Well,
Mr. Chair, I too am a little puzzled why we have to share all this information, but the need for the demographics. Can you explain to us or me again what's this great need we should get involved with?
Yeah, Mr. Chair,
Dr.
Senator, as Senator Russ mentioned, Statute 116J.401 spells out the duties of the Commissioner of Deed. A number of those duties require, for example, number 19, provide current state and sub-state labor market information and forecasts in cooperation with other agencies, compile, collect, and develop information relating to current business conditions, study trends and developments in the industries of the state, and analyze the reasons underlying the trend. And there's a number of others here. The reason that this has become of significant importance now is that, first of all, the administration of the unemployment insurance program doesn't require a determination of age or gender. So the data are not collected in the administration of the unemployment insurance program. It's just simply not there because it's not necessary for that particular program. So getting that information from a source like this is a cost-effective way of filling a gap that exists because of the characteristics of the unemployment insurance program. Now, with regard to meeting the duties of the commissioner, it has become increasingly important that we be able to say more accurately where in our state, both geographically and industry-wise, where are these retirements that are going to put a real bind on a lot of areas' ability to grow? Where is the impact of demographic changes going to have the most significant impact? And we're unable to do that at present.
Senator West. Chair, and when you talk to Commissioner, the Deed Commissioner, you're talking our State Commissioner, but what's the relationship to the federal code and why? Who are we sharing this with on the federal level?
The reference to the federal code is just to make sure that we understand what uses can be done, can be made, and what uses cannot be made of driver's license data. And so rather than just spelling it all out again, they just make a reference to the United States Code.
Thank you.
Which I read.
So thank you.
Verbatim.
So none of this information under arrest is going to the federal government. You're just using the code to connect that.
Mr. Chairman, but, Senator Western, that's a great question. No, it is not.
But we're giving Social Security numbers, names, addresses, gender, phone numbers, disability status. Do we really need to share all that information back and forth?
Well, Mr. Chairman, the department has responsibilities to do these reports. They're required by law to do them, and we have to give them the information, or I would think we would want to give them the information so that when they make the reports, we don't sit here and say, well, how can you say that? You didn't even look at X, Y, and Z. And they'll have to say, well, because we didn't have permission to do that. Would that have made the report better? Absolutely. What we're trying to do here at the department and is to make sure they have the tools in order to give us the best analysis of the wage and labor markets that they're required to present to us so that we have the best information to, along with the governor, to promote and to propose. And this, you know, it's everyone to propose legislation in response to it.
And Mr. Chair,
I don't think it's any more complicated than that, quite frankly, Mr. Chairman.
Senator West, I mean, we could also do away with some of these requirements, but by maybe your own admission or the department's own admission. So, I mean, it sounds like we've got the requirements on the books and they can't do it now, so what's the diff? Maybe we could do without this burden on the department and let them focus on things that they have been doing.
If I could address that, I tried to make the point that while
Dr. Hine,
in the past we've been able to meet the requirements, the duties of the commissioner, increasingly having information on the age profile, the how many of our workers out there are likely to be retiring in the next 5, 10, 15 years. That's become increasingly important. It becomes increasingly important for us to be able to meet that requirement of reporting on sub-state economic trends and conditions that have an impact on policy making and business decision making. And so it's become increasingly important over the years. Not that it wouldn't have been nice to have 10 years ago, but it wasn't an issue of the significance that it takes on now.
All right.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Rest.
I was just looking through my folder for requests from other committees. I would ask the committee administrator, does this bill stay here, or what happens to it?
The note I have is that it goes to the floor from here.
Okay. Then, Mr. Chairman, I would move that Senate File 1466 be recommended pass.
All right. Senator Westrom.
Mr. Chair, I'm contemplating one, because I think that's the part that probably gives us the most question. And Mr. Chair, I guess just for the committee discussion, I just moved to delete Article 1.
All right. Senator Westrom has made a motion to delete Section 1, or excuse me, Article 1, which
Article
I guess
one.
Is
Mr. Chairman,
only
I
comprised
would ask,
of Section 1.
I would ask members to vote no and to give the Department of Economic Development the tools it needs to conduct the business that we have asked it to do.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Tomasoni.
Mr. Chairman, to the witness, I realize the federal law allows all of this to be collected in other instances. Is it possible that we do it in the state without things like a Social Security number or a driver identification number, get a name, address, and telephone number, and just use that type of information as opposed to going with the Social Security number and the driver's identification number and get the same effect for your study?
So, Dr. Hein.
Chairman, Senator Tomasoni, I'm not wanting – we have Social Security numbers. I don't want Social Security numbers back. All I want is the date of birth of each individual and the gender of each individual. This doesn't request any information further than that. It is written more broadly than that, in part because I'm told that when the new driver's license system comes online, there may be such other measures as veteran status, the employment situation that our veterans face is of importance for policy making and decision making, and I wanted to leave open the possibility that as information like that becomes available on these records, we might consider including that. But right now, the only demographic measures that are of value to me and that answer the questions that are asked of us and the commissioner are the age and gender of the individuals employed in our state. We're not exchanging any other information, and there's nothing coming our way from the Department of Public Safety other than that identifier that will allow us to connect it back to the appropriate employee record and their gender and date of birth.
So, Mr. Chairman,
so,
Mr. Hein,
Dr. Hein, so you can say, you can assure the committee on the record that in no way would these individual files, these individual records, ever be connected back to a living human being. I mean, you hear the concern. The concern is privacy and confidentiality of data.
Yes.
All right.
Chairman, members of the committee, we will be treating the resultant augmented wage record in the same way that we have been and currently do treat employee records that come out of our unemployment insurance system. That's one of the bedrocks of our ability to answer questions at a very granular level about the employment situation that our citizens face.
Okay, thank you. So, Senator Thomason.
So, Mr. Chairman, Mr. Hine, would it be, I mean, why do you actually need this law in order to get people's ages and birth? What did you say the two things you need are? You need
gender and birth date.
Mr. Chair, yeah.
Dr. Hine.
Gender and date of birth.
Gender and
Mr.
date
Chair.
Of birth. Do you actually need a law to do that?
Dr. Hine.
That is the determination of the Department of Public Safety. Reading from Minnesota Statute 171.12 on the privacy of driving records, privacy subdivision 7, privacy of data, says data on individuals provided to obtain a driver's license or Minnesota identification card shall be treated as provided by United States Code Title 18, Section 2721, as in effect May 23, 2005, and shall be disclosed as required or permitted by that section. And that's the section that Senator Ress just read.
Okay, so
I'm not a lawyer, but my interpretation was that was sufficient to allow for this date of exchange. So the Department of Public Safety deemed otherwise.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Ress, would it be sufficient to just write this with those two particular provisions in it?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Thomasoni, I can't hear you.
So,
Senator Thomasoni,
is this not working? Can you hear me now?
Yeah.
Okay.
Better.
So, would you be okay with just writing this, just having the two pieces of data that they need instead of opening it up to Social Security number and photograph and name and address and everything?
But Mr. Chairman,
Senator Ress.
Senator Thomasoni, under 2721, they can't share that anyway. They can't share the things that you're just talking about anyway. It's that, and that, and Deed, as I understand it from Mr. Hine's comments, Deed thought they had the authority under the U.S. Code 2721 to have that information, and it was the Department of Public Safety that said, no, wait a minute, you need express permission under the U.S. Code 2721 to have that two pieces of additional information to add to the wage reports that you already have, and that is age, date of birth, and gender.
Mr.
Chairman, Senator Thomasoni, I don't think it's opening it up to anything. And you know it might even be the case that Deed will say, "Look, we already have the authority. We'll just go ahead."
Well, Mr. Chair,
and I don't think we want to do that. I think we want to respect the specificity that the Department of Public Safety is requiring.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Ress, according to this summary I'm reading, it says that Article 1 directs the Commissioner of Public Safety to disclose driver's license/state identification card application data defined as personal information in federal law to the Commissioner of Economic Development and to be used in labor data demographics, and then it goes on to define photograph, Social Security number, driver's identification number, et cetera. And Mr. Hine is saying you just need the date.
This is
what the Senate summary says.
I already said that.
Mm-hmm. Well, defines that information. No,
shall disclose
not.
As the code is made.
Mr. Chairman, Senator,
Dr. Hine.
That is what is defined in subsequent parts of 2721 as the personal information that can be shared. This is not meant to allow. It is not our intention to request that information. This is a labor market information office. We're interested in knowing about the age and gender-based differences in our employment situation. Driver's license pictures have no
bearing. But I think the way it's written, you have the ability to get all of those things if you want. You can get Social Security numbers, and you can get photographs, and you can get names and addresses, according to the way it's written, I think. And I think that's what Senator Westrom is concerned about.
Senator Rest.
If the intent is to limit the information to the data that they actually need, why wouldn't we, what harm does it do, Mr. Hine, to say the commissioner shall disclose, meaning the commissioner of public safety, personal information, and some phrase in there, limited to date of birth and gender to conduct its required reports, because they already have all the other stuff, and if they already have all that information, yep. And if they want to, if, and I truly believe this will be the case, we are going to be increasingly studying and asking D to study the employment environment for veterans in our state. We probably are going to come back and add veterans. But if that would make people more comfortable, as long as it doesn't, you know, I mean, it seems to me that that would be okay. I mean, it's okay with me, although it's not, it's an agency bill, okay. But if we said after the said the commissioner shall disclose personal information as defined in the United States Code Title 18, Section 2725, but limited to the recommendation of Ms. Berezovsky.
All right. So Senate Counsel has been listening to this conversation and has a suggestion.
Mr. Chair and Senator Rest, my suggestion is on line 1.15, after the word disclose, insert information relating only to date of birth and gender within the category of. So that still ties into the federal definition, but it limits it to date of birth and gender.
Mr. Chairman, I think that should give people comfort.
Well,
does me.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Westrom.
I guess I'd be interested in other committee members' thoughts, but I think that's much closer to the direction of what we're being told, and I guess I have great reservations of just listing it all and saying, well, they don't need it now, but, you know, some of us might not be here in 10 or 20 years when they just use it freely and nobody's here to say, well, they told us then they weren't going to use it and they weren't supposed to use it even though it's in law. So I would be inclined to substitute my amendment for that, but I'd be open to a few more committee members' suggestions if there's strong desire to just remove
Mr. Chairman, I would move that that amendment, amended language as read by Ms. Berezovsky. And again, if they want additional information in years to come, they should come back and ask for it.
Great. All right. So, Senator Westrom, are you willing to withdraw your motion?
Mr. Chair, I'll withdraw my oral amendment to delete Article 1 for now.
All right. So then Senator Ress moves the amendment suggested by Ms. Berezovsky, and I'll reread it. I'll just read the whole sentence. I'll read up to the comma. So the new language would read, the commissioner shall disclose, listen to me, make sure I get it right, information relating only to date of birth and gender within the category of personal information as defined in United States Code. Is that right? All right.
That's my amendment, Mr.
All right.
Chairman.
So Senator Rest moves that. Questions, members? All in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, no. Motion carries.
Then, Mr. Chairman, I would move that Senate file 1466, as amended, be recommended to pass.
Mr. Chair, one question.
Senator Westrom, then Senator Pratt.
Mr. Chair, just a question, I guess, to the agency. Senator Rest, maybe you know. Is Article 2 or 3... a backdoor attempt to get any additional information for other situations, and I'm trying to think of why some of that information is you'd need and correlate to driver's license, but are you needing it for enforcement of unpaid child support or other fines or things out there that might be tied to somebody losing their driver's license if they're getting
Mr. Chairman, if they're getting unemployment benefits?
Senator Westrom,
Articles 2 and 3 are totally separate policy things coming forth from the department. They don't have anything to do with driver's license information.
All right. Senator, so there's no connection there?
No connection.
Okay. All right. Senator Pratt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Hine, I'm just doing a little bit of on-the-fly research here. It looks like the last time we amended this 116J401 was in 2010. And I guess my question to you is, why is this needed now, and why haven't you brought this concern forward when this legislation was passed and first implemented?
Dr. Hine.
Mr. Chair, Senator, this particular statute that would contain Article 1 on DPS data sharing?
Correct.
Is that what you're referring to?
Right. You said you needed it in order to comply with 116J.401, which was passed in 2010.
One reason, as I referenced earlier, the issue of the impact of aging baby boomers in retirements has become increasingly important. Baby boomers started to hit 65 in 2011, so if I can use the fortuitous timing there as an explanation. In addition, it had been my long-standing interpretation to my layman's reading of this that we would be able to engage in this data exchange under the language as it existed. So, you know, we came here now at the insistence of the Department of Public Safety for explicit allowance for this data sharing.
All right. Thank you. Senator Rest has a motion. Would anyone else like to testify on Senate File 1466? Anything further, committee? All in favor of Senator Rest's motion to move Senate File 1466 as amended to the floor, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed, no?
No.
No.
Motion carries. Thank you, Senator Rest. All right. So, members, we need to reorder slightly. My apologies. We're going to take Senator Latz next. Senate File 1073. The bill is coming around now. A little delay in duplicating today. Senator Latz, welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members.
Should I wait until everyone has the bill, or should I just go on ahead and describe what we have here?
Go ahead.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman and members, what you have before you now for your consideration is the omnibus DWI bill that passed out of the Judiciary Committee last week, and it contains an amalgam of provisions from several different bills, including the Minnesota DWI Task Force bill, the Mothers Against Drunk Driving bill, a couple of bills that I introduced as individual provisions, a bill from Senator Jensen, and a bill from Senator Champion. And so what I'm going to do is work my way through to give you the topics here and a little bit of a detail on each provision, and then I'd be happy to answer any questions or explain anything further that you wish.
Great. Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Kiffmeyer.
Do we have a bill summary as well coming? Or a fiscal note or anything? Is there more to come yet?
Packets already.
Yeah. Yes.
And it's authored, prepared by Mr. Backus. And
pile upside down.
So you just kind of have to flip.
Fine. Here it is.
Okay, here it is.
So,
on a piece of white paper.
It's buried.
So, Mr. Chair, your position is that this bill summary is written to this first engrossment that we have here? Okay.
Is that correct?
Yes.
It is, yes. It is current. All right.
And that's what I'll be working off of as well,
great.
Mr. Chairman.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right.
Members, the first section there, describing sections 1, 10, and 16, extends the length of time to file the petition in civil court that challenges the withdrawal of driving privileges, hunting privileges, or operating privileges for including snowmobiles and ATVs from 30 days in current law to 60 days. And the basic purpose of that is that many times individuals who receive these notices of withdrawal of their privileges, if they read it at all, because it's in print somewhere on the notice of withdrawal, they don't understand the significance of it. And oftentimes they don't get into court on their first appearance until after that period for filing the petition has expired. So the proposal is to give them 60 days to be able to file that petition. So if they get into court and they become aware, either through talking to a lawyer in the courtroom or something, or the prosecutor, that there really is a petition they might want to file, they'll still have an opportunity to do that. Section 2 is the first section that deals with what's called the parity defense provisions. And I'm going to go into that in more detail when I get down to Section 9. But Section 2 specifically addresses parity and defenses for the hunting, boating, ATVing, and snowmobiling while intoxicated situations. Sections 3, 6, and 9 is a very significant provision that reduces from 0.20 to 0.16 the threshold for making a first-time offense a gross misdemeanor crime. When we did the substantial revisions in the DWI law several years ago, actually 5 or 6 years ago now, the 0.10 threshold was dropped to 0.08 for a first-time misdemeanor crime, but the 0.20, which was the threshold for making it a gross misdemeanor, at the time double the legal limit, was not dropped to 0.16 for the criminal provisions. However, it was dropped to 0.16 for the civil consequences of operating while intoxicated. The implied consent, driver's license revocation, plate impoundments, vehicle forfeitures. And so what it has, there are a couple of reasons to make the change. One is just so it's easier to keep track of all the different thresholds and the impact on persons. Just twice the legal limit is a lot easier to put the entire framework in mind. But perhaps more importantly, the science shows now that at actually about a 0.15 alcohol concentration, there's a substantial jump in the risk of getting into a crash if you're the driver. So the science backs making that the threshold, but because 0.16 is exactly twice the legal limit, we've adopted the 0.16, and this is the provision that is also a part of both the DWI task force and the Mothers Against Drunk Driving bills. You turn to the next page. Section 7 is part of the revisions to the plate impoundment law. Further down, I'll reference the fact that plate impoundment could now be accomplished by affixing a sticker to the license plate rather than physically removing the plate from the vehicle and destroying the plate. Section 7 makes it a crime for a person to remove that plate impoundment sticker. Section 8 is a preliminary breath test provision. It provides that upon request of the driver or the driver's attorney, the peace officer must disclose to the driver what the results of the preliminary screening test were. And this would happen only post-arrest, so it would not complicate the arrest process. Typically, the PBT, or preliminary breath test, is administered as the last field sobriety test, and if the results, once the results of that are known, typically the arrest takes place if there's going to be an arrest. So we did not want to complicate that arrest process. The officers need to keep a person under control at that point. But once they're past that point, then it's safe for all involved to communicate that information, including at the point at which a driver is being asked to take the more substantial and permanent alcohol concentration test further in the proceedings. And I will have an amendment to clarify some language in that section when we finish going over the content of the bill. Section 9 and Section 11 together, they allow in both the criminal defense and the implied consent license revocation proceedings all of the same legal defenses that are available in each of them now. So there are some legal defenses that you can use in criminal defense. There are some that you can use in the implied consent. The reason for the purpose of the parity provision is twofold. Number one, getting an implied consent license revocation on your record, even if you completely defeat the DWI charge, as a practical matter, can have almost all of the same consequences for a person as a DWI conviction. It counts for purposes of making any future revocations or future charges, rather, a more serious crime, a gross misdemeanor, even a felony. It counts as a prior. It brings in, with those more serious charges, the potential for mandatory minimum sentences, which can be anywhere from 30 days up to 180 days, depending on how many crimes you have that you're charged with. It has a substantial impact on your insurance as well. So the initial generator of this issue, and some of you may have heard about, is the necessity defense. And there was a Minnesota Supreme Court case in which a woman who was escaping a physical attack by her drunk husband escaped into her vehicle. They were out in the middle of nowhere at their cabin, and there was no way to get help. She couldn't run away from him. They had both been out drinking, and they had walked from the bar, which was a couple miles away, back to their cabin. So there was no DWI involved in the initial process, but he got very violent. She got into the car. He jumped to protect herself and locked the door. He got onto the front of the car, started pounding on the windshield so hard that it cracked the glass. So she escaped by driving away. The Minnesota Supreme Court ruled that she could not use the necessity defense in her implied consent license revocation case because it was not technically listed in the statutory grounds for defending against that case. So this bill adds necessity defense to the implied consent provision. It also adds to the implied consent provisions the ability to use the prescription medication defense, which is in the DWI situation. That is, if you are taking prescription medications as directed by the prescription, then you could defend yourself against a driving while impaired charge and against the implied consent revocation. It also adds the post-driving consumption defense to the criminal defenses that are available. That is, if after you are after you have been driving, are no longer in the vehicle, and you consume alcohol after that point, and if you can demonstrate as an affirmative defense that it was that post-driving consumption of alcohol that raised your alcohol concentration above the legal limit, or that impaired you, but you had not been impaired prior to that point while driving, then you have a legal defense against the crime and the implied consent license revocation. It further adds the reasonable refusal to the criminal defense. It is a defense now under the implied consent statute. It's not under the criminal defense. It's a very narrow defense. If you refuse to submit to a test and you do so on what are determined to be reasonable grounds, the case law has very narrowly limited that defense, but it's presently not available at all in the criminal case. It also provides that you cannot utilize any of these affirmative defenses without specifically giving notice to the opposing counsel, either the criminal prosecutor or the Attorney General's office in the implied consent cases. If you jump down to the next section 12 and 20, under present law to get reinstated after you've had a license revocation under the DWI law or the implied consent law, you need to take the written exam, or what's now a computer-administered exam, at the Department of Public Safety stations. This removes that written exam requirement. As a practical matter, what happens now is in connection with the resolution of any alcohol-related criminal case, a person is required to go through education class or chemical use assessment and follow up with whatever treatment might be recommended. So it was determined by the Department of Public Safety, the DWI Task Force, that the written exam requirement is time-consuming, costly, and redundant or even superfluous at this point. So we're removing that requirement. The next paragraph addresses the criminal vehicular homicide circumstances and the ignition interlock program. This was originally a part of the Mothers Against Drunk Driving bill. The premise for this is that when you have persons who do the worst thing possible that you could do while you're driving while under the influence of alcohol, get into a crash and kill someone, that under current law you can't get your driving privileges back for, I believe, it's 10 years. But we know as a matter of fact that most people or many people who have their licenses revoked are driving anyway. They are driving anyway because they need to earn a living, they need to pay the rent or pay the mortgage, take care of their family, and so on. And they're willing to take the chance of getting caught so they can take care of their other obligations in life. So what this does is it puts that ignition interlock safety device in their vehicle, and it assures that they are insured when they're driving. So that the people who most need to have this safety device in their car while they're driving will be able to get it if they commit to participate in the ignition interlock program. On the next page, section 14, this is the provision that provides for plate impoundment by sticker rather than by removing and destroying the plates. Section 15 provides that when you have that impoundment, a plate impoundment situation, the temporary vehicle permit will be for 14 days rather than the current 7 days, or if it's a blood or urine test, for 45 days. That gives more time for individuals to be able to take advantage of the other opportunities to get the ignition interlock system if they go that route installed, and to get regular license plates back so they can drive lawfully and with insurance. Section 17 provides that when you have that plate impoundment situation and you do get reinstated and your plates back with the ignition interlock program, that they are not what's commonly referred to as whiskey plates or special series plates that call you out to law enforcement and family and friends and colleagues at work. That you've got a DWI on your record. So if you go in, it's another incentive, which was part of the premise of the DWI Task Force bill and the MAD bill, another incentive for people to go into the ignition interlock program, and then they can get regular plates back. Section 18, along the same line, it provides that if your vehicle is forfeited in connection with an alcohol-related driving incident, again, if you go into the ignition interlock program, then you can get your vehicle back as long as you agree to do that ignition interlock. And that's a condition then of getting your vehicle back. The fact is most people who need to drive, if their vehicle is forfeited, they will go out and get another vehicle. They might get what sometimes is referred to as a bar car, a car that'll cost them $500. They won't have the ignition interlock program, but they're still going to be driving. Sometimes the vehicle that is forfeited is only worth $1,000 or $2,000. Sometimes it's worth $15,000 or $20,000, which is a very substantial financial hit on top of everything else. But this would be a major incentive for them to get into the ignition interlock program. And if they're at the forfeiture level offense, it's even more important for them to get into that ignition interlock program and drive with the safety device in the vehicle. Sections 19 and 29 provide that crimes related to not complying with the ignition interlock program cannot be certified by the Judicial Council as a payable offense, meaning you won't be able to just write a check and mail it in to pay for your citation. You will actually have to appear in court. Section 21 provides for an installment plan for the reinstatement fee when you get your license reinstated. It's a $680 fee to reinstate your driving privileges in Minnesota following an alcohol-related license revocation. That's a lot of money for people. There's already an exception for those who are indigent, but even if you're not quite indigent, it can still be very expensive to do so. So this would give people an opportunity to spread that cost out to 2 or even 3 years. As long as they comply with the terms of the installment plan, they can get the driving privileges back without the initial substantial financial outlay. Section 22 deals with canceled and denied inimical to public safety license reinstatement provisions. Right now, if you're canceled and denied as inimical, meaning you've had 3 or more alcohol-related driving incidents on your record, when you get your license reinstated, even with the ignition interlock device, for the first year, it's a limited license, driving only 2 or 4 work. All the other ignition interlock reinstatements do not have that limited license. The fact is, again, people are driving outside of those limits because they have to do other things in their life. This would give them full driving privileges from day one of the ignition interlock program. Another incentive, by the way, to get into the ignition interlock program rather than simply wait out the revocation period. Section 26 deals with the circumstances. There's an indigency reduction in fees for the ignition interlock program, but there is no real verification or even affirmation when someone claims to be indigent and causes the interlock provider to reduce their installation fees or their monthly fees. And so what this would put into statute is at least an affirmation as to their income levels and make it a crime for them to lie on that affirmation, and that would be submitted to the Commissioner of Public Safety at the time that they are applying for license reinstatement with the ignition interlock program. Section 27 accomplishes several different things relating to the ignition interlock program. It again addresses some provisions relating to the limited licenses that are currently required for canceled and denied inimical to public safety persons. It addresses that criminal vehicular homicide circumstance to allow them into the ignition interlock program, and it eliminates the insurance proof requirement for persons getting reinstated who do not have a history of insurance-related violations. So what's happening now is a lot of people who don't have any history of driving without insurance are still required to go through an extra step, not only to get their, you know, their notice from their agent, but also to go back and get the broker, the underlying underwriters, to sign off on verification that they have insurance. That's an administrative headache for the department, and it's an extra step for persons that don't really need it. So this would only require that extra step of documentation of insurance for those who've got a history of driving without insurance.
Mr. Chair. Senator Westrom.
To that point, Senator Latz, it says non-cancelable, also proof of non-cancelable insurance. Does that mean they have to prepay a policy for the year, or is that
Senator Latz.
What that means?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Westrom, yes. Sections 28 and 29 on the last page are related to earlier provisions I've already described to you. Section 30 applies the parity defenses that I mentioned earlier to the criminal vehicular operation law as well, but does not apply to test refusal because there is no test refusal crime in the criminal vehicular operation laws. And the last two provisions are also related to previous changes that I've already described to you. So with that, I'm happy to answer any questions. I know there are some persons here that have. And when the time is right, I've got a couple of amendments I'd like to offer to respond to some of the concerns that have been raised to me since the last hearing.
Should we take those, Senator Latz?
Sure.
All right. We don't have any amendments up here. Are they just oral amendments?
They'd be oral amendments.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I just learned of the concerns as I walked into the room here. But they should be pretty simple. So if you go to Section 8 of the bill, and let's see, I've got an older version, so let me find the page I'm looking for. So on page five.
You don't have the first engrossment?
I do now.
Oh, okay.
My notes were on a previous.
Oh, I see, page. I see.
So if you go to page 5, line 21, the proposed amendment would be to delete everything after the word immediately, except for the period. And this is relating to the disclosure of the PBT results to a driver who requests that information. The provision that I propose to delete is that the peace officer who administered the test must be the one to disclose that information. Sometimes that arresting officer is not the one who is administering the breath test back at the station. The information should be available to that breath test operator, but it may not be the same person. So
all right.
It would just require the immediate disclosure, but not by that same arresting officer.
So,
Mr. Chair, I'd move that amendment.
Senator Newman moves that amendment? Okay. Senator Champion, do you have a question?
No, I was okay. Going to move them.
So Senator Newman moves to delete everything after the word immediately up to the period on line 5.21. Any questions, members? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed no. Motion carries. All right. And another
Thank
one.
You. And then, Mr. Chairman, in Section 9, the line 6.15, and I was drafting a little bit on the fly here, so I'm not sure if this is going to be the perfect language, but it will certainly indicate the intent. And certainly if counsel wants to suggest something better, I'm open to it, or I can return to Judiciary Counsel, who drafted the bill, to clean up the language at some point. But what I would propose to do is, at the end of the line, before the period, after the word influence, insert, if they were not under the influence at the time of the violation. And the point of this would be that this is the post-driving consumption defense, which is very easy to implement when you've got an alcohol concentration test that's taken an hour and a half after they were driving. And the point of that defense, again, was that if you weren't drunk when you drove, but you got drunk after you drove, that's not illegal, right? But we don't want to be in a situation where if they can simply prove that they got drunk after drinking, after driving, that would negate actually having committed a crime if they were, in fact, under the influence when they were driving. So this would allow that defense, but only if they weren't, in fact, drunk while they were driving, which is the crime that we still want the state to be able to prove if they can.
So the language reads, if they were not under the influence at the time of the violation. Council may have an alternative.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Newman.
Senator Latz, I would assume then by including this proposed language or something similar to it, this would simply be a matter of proof at the time of trial. Would that be your reason for inserting it?
Yes, Mr.
Chair. Senator
Latz. Senator Newman, yes, these defenses would be submitted to a jury and it'd be a finding of fact.
Right.
And the jury would have to decide if the initial crime was committed, and then also if the affirmative defense, which by definition means the defendant has to prove it, was proven.
Thank you, Senator Latz.
Okay. Council has maybe a different approach to suggest.
Mr. Chair, on 6.13, after the word defendant, insert, was not under the influence at the time of the violation and... So that it would be part of the affirmative defense to prove absence of being under the influence.
So your words are that the defendant was not under the influence at the time of the violation and?
Yes.
Consumed a sufficient quantity of alcohol, et cetera.
And what?
Does that work,
Mr.
Senator
Chairman?
And what?
The only thing I'm trying to figure out is how that squares up with the state's burden of proof beyond a reasonable doubt that a person was under the influence while flipping the burden for an affirmative defense. So I'd have to think a little bit about how that works, and I'm prepared to accept that for now, and just if we'll noodle on the exact implications of the language.
Yeah, so I think we all agree on what you're trying to accomplish. So, Senator Tomasoni.
Can you read the whole thing, though?
So sure. So,
after the time of the
so
violation.
It is an affirmative defense to a violation, and then the violations are listed. So it's providing an affirmative defense that the defendant was not under the influence at the time of the violation and consumed a sufficient quantity of alcohol, controlled substance, or hazardous substance, or a combination of those elements after the time of the violation to cause the defendant to be under the influence. So, in other words, the individual was so not under the
so
influence.
So the amendment was made
but
on
became under the influence later.
13.
So then they can't be enhanced or charged for something they did after. Can't be made a part of the original violation.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Letts, is that not the law now?
Senator Letts.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Tomasoni, that's correct.
So what are we doing here? Are we
making the law better?
Clearer?
Yes.
You like this is the kind of thing that Rangers like.
Well, I don't know if we like to prove it.
All right. So, Senator Movement will move that as suggested by counsel. Any questions, members? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, no. Motion carries. All right. All right. Questions to the bill, members? Senator Westrum.
Mr. Chair, Senator Letts, back to the section that lowers the criminal penalty from 0.20 to 0.16.
Senator Letts.
I was here for the debate on the 0.10, 0.08. Do you recall any rationale on, I don't recall if you were here then in the House or not, but what was the rationale for keeping 0.20 and this to me seems like maybe the most substantial move in enhanced penalties, and I'm not saying that necessarily is good or bad, but I'm just I guess wanting to have us discuss it a little bit so we kind of understand the ramifications of it, because I have a follow-up question then too.
Senator
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, Senator Westrum. Yes, I was here in my first term in the Senate when this was passed. Initially, I believe Senator Murphy carried the bill at the time. I think the rationale at the time was more, I think part of it was just a political compromise. Dropping from 0.10 to 0.08 was a substantial move. That did bring us more in line with the national trend on that. But there was a concern about when you get to the point of a gross misdemeanor crime, which also carries with it significant additional consequences. Your maximum penalty then is a year in jail instead of 90 days. Then there was resistance to making that big move down to 0.16. At the time, I'm not sure if the science was there. It might have been. I just don't recall. That backed up statistically the increase in risk of crashing at 0.15 or thereabouts. And the part of the compromise to get the bill passed was also to move the 0.20 down to 0.16 for the administrative consequences or the civil consequences relating to the same incident. The length of the license revocation currently gets much longer at 0.16. It goes from 90 days to 1 year. The plate impoundment takes effect at 0.16 now and not 0.20. So the numbers, the threshold was dropped on the civil administrative consequence side, but it was not dropped on the criminal side. So now it created difficulty in the sense for practitioners And certainly for people who weren't really familiar with the law, to try to figure out exactly which consequences applied at which thresholds. But now, anyway, the hope is to align everything more cleanly and to align it with the science that's on the topic.
And Mr. Chairman, Senator Latz, I know one of the things that was evolving at the same time was enhanced penalties for repeat offenses, with the idea of the first offense is bad, but if you continue to do a bad behavior, we're gonna make the penalties worse. And so refresh our committee memories and myself on a second offense, do you lose your license whether you're over .08 or not? And the idea is, if you're going to be double the legal limit here, or what formerly or currently is .20 or above, we kind of throw you into that second offense because you were over the limit so much that we want to enhance the penalty. Is that kind of where we're going with this? And that's, am I correct on the second offense? Does you do lose your license for a year?
Senator Latz. Yeah,
Mr. Chairman, Senator Westrom, you're half correct,
okay.
Which is part of the confusion the way the law is currently written. If you have a first offense now and you hit a .20 threshold, there is no mandatory minimum sentence if you're convicted. But you do lose your license for a year instead of for 90 days. So it's longer license revocation, plate impoundment, and if it's a repeat offense, it's an aggravating factor for forfeiture. But there's no mandatory minimum sentence until you get to a repeat offense. So making it a gross misdemeanor now, as this bill proposes, at a .16 would still not make it a mandatory minimum sentence if you're convicted, although you will probably have prosecutors asking for maybe a little bit more than they would on a first offense low test, or judges sentencing a little more harshly than they would on a first offense low test. But the statute wouldn't mandate a minimum jail sentence or minimum time on house arrest.
And Mr. Senator Chairman, Senator Latz, the ignition interlock, we're making some changes, allowing that to be an option of choice or an option for more insurance, I guess I would call it, of safety and driving for somebody that's had a violation. Is that an option for somebody who loses their license for a year to get their license back? And where I'm going with this question is a little to your comments about, you know, we can kind of sit in a bubble here and talk about what are the laws and what would be the, you know, practical balance and how do we get hard on offenders. But then there's this thing called life that goes on out there, which is what I think you're trying to address. And, I've had constituents contact me in the last year that have lost their license to this exact point, happen to be over the .20 limit. But economically, it really, really is a problem. And I don't know whether or not there's another alternative or not, but I'm wondering, with the ignition interlock, is that an option for somebody to not lose their license for 12 months on the first offense that's over now .16 under your bill, or currently on over .20?
Senator Latz.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Westrom, yes, it's an option. In fact, it's a requirement. If you want to get your driving privileges back before the expiration of the usual revocation period.
Okay.
So if you're a first-time offender, .20 test, you're facing a one-year license revocation, you have two options. Either wait out the one-year revocation period and not drive legally, or join the ignition interlock program and you can drive immediately with full driving privileges for that entire one-year revocation period. It's particularly a challenge, as you pointed out, from your own constituency and in greater Minnesota, where options for getting around other than your own car are much more limited. So you may not have bus service to get from, from one part of your district to another, if that's where your job is. and you're stuck with the choice of either driving illegally or getting the ignition interlock program. And I just want to clarify one thing. Maybe counsel can verify this. It just occurred to me. I want to make sure the ignition interlock program requirements also drop from the 2.0 to the 0.16. So if we can verify that, if it's not in the bill, I want to make sure it is.
And Mr. Chairman, Senator Latz, appreciate that. Ignition interlock, do we have, do you offhand know about a rough cost for participants? I know there's a monthly monitoring fee they have to pay, and then I think there's an initial up front, and I think you were around. I was an early supporter of the ignition interlock with along with several other members that are still around the legislature, but what's the cost for folks that have to or elect to use this option?
Yeah.
Senator Latz.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Senator Westrom. Yeah, I was an early supporter, too. I carried the initial pilot program in Hennepin and Beltrami counties and then the statewide pilot program before it was finally implemented as a statewide permanent program. And the initial cost is roughly around $100 to $125 for installation of the device and then roughly around $100 a month for the maintenance and the downloading of the testing data and so on. Now, there's some other costs that get in there, including an early termination fees and a deinstallation fee, and it does turn out to be a bit of a financial burden for folks. But that's a concern to me, frankly. When you factor all the costs in, it's still probably a whole lot cheaper to get the ignition interlock device in your vehicle and be able to keep your job. Right. So people ought to be doing that. But, again, not everyone is doing it. And that's part of the reason the task force came forward with these additional incentives to join the ignition interlock program is because their numbers, and I don't remember what the numbers are, not as many people as should be using the ignition interlock program are using it.
So, Mr. Chair, Senator Latz, to that point, I mean, do we foresee or potentially anticipate or have we heard anything from industry that would indicate if the user use of this device and technology became greater, the price might go down? Let me just equate it to the home alarm systems that, you know, decades ago were probably $50, $100, $200 a month, and I hear them now advertised for $14, $15 a month. Is that a possibility, or have we heard anything on that, or don't we know?
Senator Latz.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Westrom, no participants in the provider industry have told me that they were going to reduce their fees if there are more customers. It might be a natural market consequence of that. It might also be a natural market consequence if there are more providers meet the qualifications to provide in Minnesota, and if there are more potential customers, you get more entrance into the marketplace, and that's probably, that competition would probably drive those costs down more than anything else.
Thank you.
All right. Questions? Senator Kiffmeyer.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senator Latz, interesting bill. I remember the original ignition interlock, so it's kind of good to have that history. One of the things I wonder about, though, is on line 21 of the first engrossment.
Which page, please?
Page 20, line 20, 21.
The discounted rate line?
Mm-hmm. And so my concern here is that someone is giving a sworn statement that they are indigent in order to get a discounted rate. And then it is found out they have submitted false information, which to me is perjury, lying on an official document. But the only penalty is they just have to pay the regular rate. So it seems like not much of a deterrent to go ahead and give it a try, because what the heck. And that all the worst that happens is they deny the participant the discounted rate. It seems as though it might be a little saving of effort here as well to go through that if they should do so, that they should certainly pay more than the regular rate as a part of that immediate consequence.
Mr. Chair, I'm just looking through my bill summary to see if I can identify the section. I believe
It's section 26 on page 20.
I understand, but no, but I think there may be a separate provision that makes it a crime to submit a false statement to that effect as well. But I'm not sure if that's in the bill. But as you pointed out, Senator Kiffmeyer, is a crime, is perjury to do that.
Oh,
well.
Senator Latz, yeah, section 29, I think it says so.
There we go. Thank you.
It says knowingly submits false material to the Commissioner of Public Safety for a discounted rate is guilty of a misdemeanor.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman and Senator Latz. While I'm sympathetic to that, I also would prefer that the immediacy of the effect, because they're going to feel it right there when they do that. And the theme of our whole thing was kind of on the first time you maybe just get that. On a second offense maybe becomes, now I hope it never gets there, don't want them to get there, but I want compliance rather than. And so, Senator Lott, you know this subject area very, very well. So I'm making it a comment at this time. I don't have suggested language unless you think it would fit, because there's a lot of language in this bill that interrelates with each other that I respect your knowledge of that. I'm making a comment that could lead to a change or not.
Senator Latz.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Kiffmeyer, I appreciate the comment. My concern is that the same incentive that drives people maybe to submit inaccurate income information so they can get the lower rate would have the opposite of our intended effect here. If you were to cause them to pay more, as a penalty, a higher than usual rate, because then they're even less likely to try to stay in the ignition interlock program. And I do want people to get into the ignition interlock program. It's a proven safety device for all of everyone. So I don't know that I'd want to add an additional financial penalty on there other than criminalizing the submission of false information.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I appreciate that, although I think the criminal penalty is significant financial as well. But I will leave it at that and see what happens as the bill moves forward, because I would agree with you that we want them working. We want them to be able to have something that allows them to keep driving, and yet the training wheels, you might say, of the ignition interlock, that's a constructive thing. And so I think some of the other things in this, there's a balance to it all. So thank you very much.
All right. Thank you. Questions, members? Senator Thomas.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Letts, what kind of remedies are there for when the ignition interlock system doesn't work correctly?
Senator Letts.
I mean, I've heard from my constituents quite a bit that it didn't work right. Somebody else tried to drive the car, and I got blamed for it and all that kind of stuff. What are the is there a positive defense for these people who have done nothing wrong, but the system doesn't work right?
Senator Latz.
Chairman, DPS administers it, and so they can probably give you more details on how that's handled. But my understanding is if there's a first false positive result, for example, it's usually overlooked by the department. Sometimes there are technical problems with the equipment, and they would handle that. And my understanding also is that all the devices are now required to have cameras, so that it can verify who it is that's sitting in the driver's seat blowing into the device trying to get the car started.
Welcome to the committee.
Hi. Jody Askerson with the Minnesota Office of Traffic Safety.
Can you pull the microphone real close? They're not working very well today for some reason. That or my hearing is going. I'm not sure which.
Jody Askerson with the Minnesota Office of Traffic Safety. Mr. Chair, Senator Tomasoni. To answer your question, there are cameras in the vehicles that are required on every installation. And if a person has a false positive, they are not immediately used against the person. If the person does have a problem with it, they also have the opportunity to file administrative review with the department. And the department will pull those pictures and see who was driving it. And if there was action that can be reversed, they will just take that They will remove that from the record. So there are options for the drivers to address that situation. If there's a problem with the device, the department works with the manufacturers to find out if there had been issues and works with the customer.
And Senator Thompson.
And then, Mr. Chair, and then how long do they have to have? I mean, is each case different, or how long they have to have the beyond the interlock, or is it, I mean, can it be 10 years, or can it just be 1 year? I mean, what's the, it depends on the individual, depends on the offense. How does that work?
Mr. Chair, Senator, with the people that are revoked, there is a 90-day requirement that they have no failed breaths in the last 90 days, and if they are, they're extended 90 days. The purpose of that was when this law was originally going through the process of being created back in 2010, we found out from other states that if Washington State particularly, they did not monitor their offenders. And 2 months after a person was taken off interlock, they killed an infant. And when they went back and looked at those tests, they found out that he was failing every day. And if they would have kept him on the device, that child would have been saved. And so this language ensures that the person is learning. It's changing their behavior, that they don't get in a car and drink and drive. So if there's a fail, they're extended 90 days. As for the people that have multiple offenses that are canceled inimical, they have to show abstinence. So if there is a fail, then their time is started over. So if they have to show 3 years of abstinence and they have a fail, and it's a valid fail, then they start the time over for 3 more years.
And my last question is there... is there any kind of a reduced rate for people who don't have the ability to pay for the interlock system? Or is there any kind of graduated schedule for somebody who wants to drive, has doesn't have a good job, so doesn't have very much money, and really can't afford the device?
Ms. Askelson.
Mr. Chair, Senator, there is an indigent rate that the state put forward to the manufacturers that are for a monthly rate of $40 if they qualify, and that's at 140% of the national poverty line. But that is one of the reasons that there was changes brought back up from the DWI law review is because of the expense to the offenders. The goal is to get more legal drivers in the state. As Senator Latz stated, there's a high amount of people driving illegally in Minnesota and nationally, at least 70%.
And
Now in our program, in the Minnesota program, there's 8,400 people. Probably should have closer to 21,000, but it just the expense to an offender is so high that that's why there's incentives to try and get people into the program.
And one last question of the DWIs that are issued each year, how many of them actually involve an accident?
Ms. Askelson.
Mr. Chair, Senator, I don't have those results right with me. I can certainly look it up here. I have my stats with me, and I can bring that back up to the table.
I'd love to know that because I think it's relevant to this change from 0.20 to 0.16 because if people aren't actually getting in accidents, but they're being charged as really, really bad criminals, it seems to me we're going a little bit too far.
Mr. Chair, Senator.
Ms. Oskarson.
The problem is that there are more fatalities and severe injury at 0.15 and above, and that is where the highest amount of those happen, is at that level. And I can get the statistics from 2013 to you here shortly.
Okay.
But that is a concern, is the amount of fatality, not just fatalities. We had 88 people that died in 2013 due to alcohol. But the severe injuries where the person is incapacitated for the rest of their life is of major concern to us.
Well, right. So
I would like to see those statistics.
Okay. I'm sorry, Senator Trump, sorry. Okay. I think Senator Latz, Ms. Berezovsky might have an answer to your earlier question. about whatever it was.
Mr. Chair and Senator Latz, I think you wanted to be sure that an individual who was revoked or canceled because of a violation of 169A.20 with a concentration of 0.6 or more was eligible for ignition interlock?
Right. I want to make sure we picked up that drop for the ignition interlock program as well as for the other things.
Mr. Chair and Senator Letts, I don't see that reference at all in the current law on who is a program participant, an eligible program participant. I don't know if Ms. Oscarson or the department would have any other comment on that, but if you want it to be included, I could propose some language.
Yeah. Well, it would essentially be a conforming change to match up with everything else that we're doing. So I'd be interested if the department is taking a look at the bill and if they could indicate that they think it's already in there, or if we need some additional language, I'd like to be able to add that either here or at some other point in the process.
So did you want to propose?
John Kupczynski is coming up.
Ms. Kupczynski? Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Joan Kupczynski. I'm the Driver Services Director. If you would, Ms. Berezovsky, could you repeat the question? I'm sorry. We were talking.
Ms. Berezovsky.
Mr. Chair, the question is whether there is now a reference to the 0.20 threshold for DWI under who can participate in ignition interlock, so who is a program participant. And if so, is it necessary to make a conforming change to bring the 0.20 down to 0.16? And I couldn't find any reference to 169A.20 or to the 0.20 threshold. So.
And Mr. Chair?
Ms. Kupczynski.
I do not have that answer. I apologize. We will find the information and share it with the committee or with Senator Latz.
Mr. Chair, it will be my intent, if it's not already covered in the bill, that I would offer at some point a conforming amendment to make sure that threshold for participation in the ignition interlock program is picked up at 0.16.
So, Ms. Berezovsky has a suggestion if you want to hear it.
Let's go ahead. Yeah.
Mr. Chair and Senator Letts, if you want to deal with it at here, my suggestion is simply at 19.27, before the semicolon, to insert "or for a violation of section 169A.20 while having an alcohol concentration of 0.16 or more," because I don't find that reference anywhere else in 171.306.
Mr. Chair, while they're looking at that, can Council just restate what is it this amendment would do to Senator Latz's earlier point? I forgot what.
So it's important to read the paragraph prior. So this has to do with the who would be required to participate in the ignition interlock device program. This would fall under the definition of program participant. So a person who is qualified to take part in the program and whose driver's license has been revoked, canceled, or denied for various reasons, including for a violation of 169A.20 while having an alcohol concentration of 0.16 or more. 0.16 or more.
I would ask for that amendment, please, Mr. Chairman.
All right.
Mr. Chairman, I'll move the amendment.
Senator Newman moves that amendment. Questions on the amendment? All in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, no. Motion carries. All right. Further questions, members? I see we have someone on the list here to testify, City Attorney Mary Ellen Heng. Welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Mary Ellen Heng. I am the criminal deputy for the Minneapolis City Attorney's Office. I'm here on behalf of my office as well as the St. Paul City Attorney's Office. Our two offices prosecute a fair number of DWIs. My office alone does about 1,600 DWIs. And so we had just a few comments about a couple of portions of the bill. Before I state my comments, I do want to thank Senator Latz. We had a chance to meet with him briefly to express some of our concerns, and he did attempt to address some of them with his amendments, and we do appreciate that. It was kind of short notice that we caught him with those changes, but we do appreciate his willingness to hear our concerns on the bill. The first section that we are concerned with is Section 8, which would require the results of the PBT to be disclosed. It would be our preference that that not be included. From our perspective, disclosing the results of the preliminary breath test doesn't serve any legal purpose. Regardless of what that preliminary breath test comes out at, whether it comes out as a 0.06, 0.09, a 0.16, if the police officer has probable cause to believe the person is driving under the influence, they may require them to take the test. And the person is required to take that test or be charged with criminal refusal. So it doesn't seem to serve any purpose to disclose what that test result is or make it mandatory. If anything, it will only lead to confuse the person. We see this all the time. People refuse because, well, I already took the test, or I took the test and it was below 0.08, so why do I have to take this test? So I think all by requiring the disclosure of the PBT, even though we know a lot of officers do disclose it upon being asked, to make it a requirement with the remedy of suppression seems to be an extreme result when it really doesn't serve any legal purpose when it comes to the crime of test refusal. With that said, if that is going to be left in the bill, we do appreciate the amendment that was made. One concern we may have is we'd like to maybe further discuss the use of the word immediately disclose. That's a legal term that could be open to a lot of interpretation. So if we have a case where the person asked for it to be disclosed before they take the final test result and that officer wasn't the officer that administered the PBT, and maybe it takes that officer 10 or 15 minutes to find that result and disclose that, is that immediate enough, or would that I could see a court say, no, 15 minutes is not immediate enough, and therefore, even though they disclosed it, suppression would still be the end result. So we may like to further discuss some of that language. Our second concern was with Section 9, and it was the post-driving consumption applying to under the influence. It already applies to the test result, and that makes sense because, and I'm no scientist, but the science behind test results, as we know, people can be on the way up when they're stopped, or they can be on the way down. And so post-driving consumption, if proven, could affect the test result. But one of the senators, and I don't remember who it was, I think kind of hinted at it in that we really don't need this defense to apply when we're talking about prosecuting someone for driving under the influence. There's two types of prosecution that we do. We prosecute people for driving under the influence, meaning we have to show they were impaired. We do this through field sobriety tests. Other indicia of alcohol the officer might see, driving conduct, and we prosecute them for being over the legal limit. They are two separate and distinct offenses. And if a person is proven to be under the influence at the time they drove, it's completely irrelevant that they consumed alcohol afterwards. That's only going to add to their impairment. But if we can show that they were impaired at the time they drove, post-driving consumption really shouldn't come into play. And so we do oppose that section. But if it is going to be in, we do appreciate the amendment to make it clear that if the person is proven to be under the influence, that that would not apply as a defense. But it does seem, I think, to be irrelevant to what we're trying to prove. The third section is in the same section. It's the reasonable refusal. And this one is a little bit more complicated. Reasonable refusal right now is available as a defense in the implied consent proceeding, which is a civil proceeding with a lower burden of proof. And that term is not defined in any statute. It's been defined by case law over years and years of appellate work for judges making rulings and appeals going up, and that's been narrowly defined as to what might be reasonable. Our concern is, how are we going to codify that in a criminal statute or a criminal jig? If we leave that up to a jury instruction, it still opens the door for interpretation, for possible nullification, or for defense attorneys to argue, or juries to say, well, we understand the definition is this narrow, but this defense this person put forward seems very reasonable. And I think it's much better left in the implied consent proceeding and left up to the judge. If you put it into the criminal context, it's really going to be in the hands of the jury as to what is reasonable. And I think it's so hard to define as it is that we're just going to be opening ourselves up kind of to a can of worms for that. And the only last comment I would make is under Section 18. While my office fully supports the use of the ignition interlock, we think that's a great tool. Our one concern is, unless we can guarantee the interlock could be placed on the vehicle at the impound lot, and I'm not an expert in this area, but I've been told by others that some of the providers don't want to come to the impound lots where vehicles get towed upon arrest to put the interlock on. If we don't forfeit vehicles and release vehicles back to offenders, who's going to follow up and monitor to make sure that interlock actually gets put on the vehicle and that they follow through with that? So there might need to be some discussions around that point.
All right. Senator Latz, 4 points.
Go ahead. Sure. Thank you, Madam Chair and members. With regard to the preliminary breath test disclosure, frankly, I think it is relevant information for a driver in deciding whether or not to take the test back at the station. Although state law does require that they submit to the test, state law also allows them the option of declining to take that test. This basically was in response to Schmerber versus California, in which the Supreme Court said that the state has the right to hold someone down and to get the contents of their stomach forcibly if they want to, but we choose not to do that in a DWI context. So we create legal incentives for people to agree to submit to the test voluntarily, and we criminalize their refusing to submit to that test. The fact is, and many defense attorneys anyway will tell you this, they would like to know what that PBT result was so that they can advise their clients when they are contacted prior to that testing decision whether it is in that client's best interest to submit to the test and potentially suffer the consequences of the results of that test, or to refuse to the test and accept the consequences of refusal. So it's at least relevant to that decision for the individual facing a test decision, which they have a right, I would submit to you, to have that information. With regard to the post-driving defense for under the influence or being impaired, I've already attempted to clarify that matter. I'm going to go back and take another look in light of the questions that were raised about that, just to see if it all really fits together well and works well together. With regard to the reasonable refusal defense to DUI, the fact is it's not only is it a crime to refuse testing, but it's a more serious crime for a first-time offender. So if you have no prior DWIs, you are at a 0.08 alcohol concentration, but you may not realize it. But maybe the PBT said you're at a 0.08 alcohol concentration. And because you think you know the law, you didn't get a hold of a lawyer at 3 o'clock in the morning, you tried a few and you couldn't reach one, or you left a message for an answering service, they didn't get back to you in time, and you just think, you know what, I've heard somewhere I don't have to give up evidence against myself, so I'm going to decline to take the test. I'm going to refuse the test. Okay, stupid decision in most cases, poorly informed decision based on ignorance, but nevertheless, they refuse at that first offense, and they're guilty of a gross misdemeanor crime. So, yes, there's a lot of incentive, but they're not to take the test, but they're not even informed that the penalty is a gross misdemeanor rather than a misdemeanor. They're simply told it's a crime to refuse.
So they don't realize they're committing even a more serious crime. They don't realize that their license is going to be revoked for a year instead of for 90 days. And they don't realize how much easier it is to prove that they violated the criminal refusal statute than it would be to prove an underlying DWI case. So a lot of these decisions get made out of ignorance, and frankly, there are prosecuting attorneys that will absolutely refuse to give you a break on a refusal, even if they've got a PBT that is later part of the criminal evidence in the reports that shows they were a .08 or a .09 test. They still won't give you a break. You refuse, you live with the consequences because that's what the law says. So in my judgment, I think it makes sense for a defendant to at least have the opportunity to express to a jury, with the jury instructions from the judge as to the current state of the law, which is very, very narrow, but at least to be able to express to the jury that, you know, their refusal was a dumb thing to do. That doesn't mean they can't get convicted of the underlying driving while impaired charge. That'll be a separate charge, and that's provable by the performance on the field sobriety tests and the observations of the officer and any admissions that the person might have made in the course of the arrest process or an interview afterward. But I think it's fair to at least give them the opportunity to assert that their refusal was based on reasonable grounds, just as they can make that assertion in the implied consent license revocation case. And finally, with regard to the ignition interlock installation at the impound lot, I suspect that if you have that many more people who are going to be participating in the ignition interlock program so that they can get their vehicle back rather than let it go to forfeiture, that the providers are going to find a way to install it at the impound lot if that's where it needs to be done. There are some providers already that do mobile installation of the device. I think it happens more often in greater Minnesota because it's more convenient to get the customers to go out to the location of the vehicle rather than to require them to drive in to wherever the installation location, permanent location is. And I suspect you will find metro area providers very quickly will adopt or set up mobile device installation programs so they can capture that additional a marketplace. And in addition, if you're at the point of a forfeiture, it's going to be a much longer revocation, a much longer contract for the ignition interlock, so it'll be even more worth the while the provider to incur maybe some additional expense to have the mobile device installed, or the mobile installation process, because they're going to get a much longer stream of revenue as a result of that installation on a forfeiture case.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Newman.
I'll comment, Mr. Chairman, members, very briefly on three of the items that the city attorney brought up. First would be the disclosure of the preliminary test under Section 8. This is a test that law enforcement is performing with respect to somebody that has been stopped for DWI. DWI, as we have been discussing for quite a while now, is a very, very serious crime. I see absolutely no reason that the defendant, the person that has been charged, and just as importantly, his attorney or her attorney, be able to review that evidence and take it into consideration in the defense. It just doesn't make any sense to me at all that law enforcement is not obligated to provide that information to the person who is charged. I see no reason why we should change that particular article. I'll lump the Section 9 affirmative defense of driving after consumption or after consumption and the reasonable refusal. Both of those are affirmative defenses. There are defenses that the defendant has to prove. And the notion that we shouldn't allow them to bring that defense up because it is a difficult issue or item for a jury to consider or for a judge to provide the jury with the necessary instructions. Really, I don't put a lot of stock in. Judges would instruct a jury on consumption after driving and would provide instructions to a jury as to what the law is on reasonable refusal, and it's very, very narrow. And we have to rely on the judges that they will appropriately instruct a jury on those issues. And then we let the jury decide, just like they decide in any other kind of a case. They decide what the facts are, and they decide whether or not the defendant has sustained his burden of proof on the affirmative defenses. So I think it's absolutely appropriate that we allow a defendant to come forward with those very, very narrow affirmative defenses, prove it if he can, and then let the jury do their job.
Thank you, Senator Newman. Ms. Oskerson, did you have something to add?
Mr. Chair, Senator, you asked about the crash information. Of the 88 drivers that were killed, and they were 49 of them were at 0.15 and above, so over half were at 0.15 and above. And there were over 3,600 crashes that were alcohol-related in 2013. I don't have that broken down, but I can get that information to you at a later time.
Mr. Chairman, and
Senator Thompson,
what percentage of DWIs were not involved in a crash?
What percentage of DWIs?
We're not involved in a crash.
Oh.
DWIs that we know about.
Huh?
DWIs that we know about.
Oh, no, they got issues.
Right.
They don't have to be in a crash to get a DWI.
Right.
Right.
Yeah.
There was...
Ms. Oskers.
Mr. Chair, Senator, what percentage were not involved in a crash?
Yeah.
Well, there were over 25,000 DWIs in 2013, so...
Well, most of them were not involved. Most of them were not involved in a crash.
Mr. Chair, Senator, correct.
Right.
Which is why the moving the 0.2 down to 0.16, I think, is a problem because the people that got in serious crashes had high alcohol content, but that doesn't mean that everybody does. And so I think at some point we have to maybe reconsider the amount of punishment that we give these people, and I think it's inappropriate to actually move the 0.2 down to 0.16.
All right. Thank you. Anything further, members? Would anyone else like to testify on Senate File 1073? Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is David Bernstein, and I'm the chairman of Minnesota's DWI Task Force. For those of you that are unfamiliar, the task force is a collaboration statewide of prosecutors, defense attorneys, judges, probation officers, law enforcement, the Department of Public Safety, everyone involved with a stake in DWIs, Mothers Against Drunk Driving, Minnesotans for Safe Driving, treatment providers. We get a lot of input. The goal of the DWI task force is to share ideas and information and knowledge, and when agreed upon to move for legislation. And so the DWI task force has met for approximately 35 years, and over the past few years has developed initiatives as part of this bill that I'd like to identify and also discuss some of the comments that task force members have had in their capacities with respect to other provisions that were not part of our bill. The DWI task force determined that our goals this session were, and always, are to try and provide for valid, safe drivers, valid driver's licenses, and safe on the roads. And so our recommendations were meant to further those provisions. And I want to identify specifically the provision regarding lowering the legal limit from 0.20 to 0.16 was part of the DWI Task Force's initiatives. The DWI Task Force fully endorses and supports that provision. I won't reiterate the reasons for it. I think Senator Latz demonstrated those eloquently. I do want to address briefly Senator Tomasone's concerns. There is research indicating that the most dangerous drivers on the road are 0.15 or above, and that's research that's been done by the Department of Public Safety as well as the National Highway Traffic and Safety Administration. There was a study done in 1996 which indicates that while drivers with alcohol concentrations in excess of 0.15 are only 1% of all drivers on weekend nights, they are involved in nearly 50% of all fatal crashes at that time. And so the DWI task force looked at the research And number one, we were concerned with equating the civil penalties with the criminal penalties. But in addition to that, there's been research and more recent research done in 2011 and 2013, which has shown that drivers with an alcohol concentration of 0.15 or above are significantly more dangerous, and in fact, as dangerous as drivers with levels of 0.20 or above. And that's why the DWI Task Force made that recommendation and fully supports and endorsed that provision of the bill. The DWI Task Force also supports and fully endorses Sections 12 and 20, which removes the offender from passing a DWI written test in order to reinstate their valid driver's license. As Senator Latz indicated, the written test was seen as duplicative and perhaps superseded by education provided by the courts. It was particularly difficult for individuals from rural areas to travel to a testing center to take the test. And so for these reasons, the DWI Task Force suggested removing this requirement, which will allow drivers to get valid a little bit easier. The DWI Task Force recommended Sections 14 and 15, the permanent sticker, and increasing the temporary notice or valid driver's license from 7 to 14 days. The DWI Task Force fully supports and endorses Section 17, which allows for someone in the Ignition Interlock Program to receive regular license plates as opposed to the non-whiskey plates. Section 21, amending the DWI providers to allow their driver's license reinstatement fee to be paid in installments. That suggestion was made by the DWI Task Force and is fully supported and endorsed. And Section 27, with the exception of the CVH offenders, that was a provision that was suggested by MAD. All the other provisions were fully endorsed and supported by the DWI Task Force to have a valid driver's license with the Ignition Interlock Program as opposed to the limited license. And so those provisions of this bill were suggested by the task force and are fully supported and endorsed. This omnibus bill and the first engrossment of the new bill came rather quickly, and so the DWI Task Force has not had an opportunity to vote on whether or not to endorse the entirety of this bill. But I have received some emails and some comments that I wanted to share with this committee regarding some concerns of some of the provisions. And I do want to start with Section 8, the PBT. This provision was generally supported by the defense attorneys on the task force. It was generally opposed by the prosecutors on the task force for the same reasons that Ms. Hang suggested. So I will not reiterate those here. But I do want to note that the private citizens were generally supportive of this provision. They indicated, similar to what Senator Newman said, that they would like to know what the PBT result is. But I did want to note that prosecutors had the same concerns Ms. Hang brought up. Those prosecutors were from the Minneapolis City Attorney's Office, the St. Paul City Attorney's Office, the Dayton City Attorney's Office, the Dakota County Attorney's Office, and the Scott County Attorney's Office. With respect to Section number 9, the parity and defenses, again, the defense attorneys on the task force were supportive of this provision. The prosecutors on the task force were not supportive of this provision for the same reasons that Ms. Hang indicated, so I won't reiterate those here. But again, from those same agencies, the prosecutors collectively were not supportive of this provision. And finally, with respect to Section, I believe it is 18, the allowing an offender to obtain a forfeited vehicle back if the ignition interlock is provided. The task force members had the same concerns that Ms. Hang brought up regarding how to follow through to determine if an offender put the ignition interlock on the vehicle. And I've spoken to some of the ignition interlock vendors who have indicated that they do not have the means to install the ignition interlock at the impound lot. So what we're doing is trusting individuals who get their car returned to them that they will go put the ignition interlock on their vehicle. We have no means to follow up on that. So that is a great concern. Although I will say that the DWI task force is very much supportive of ignition interlock, and we'd like to see it implemented more, but we want to ensure that it's actually being installed in the cars other than just promises that it will be. I also want to note that the DWI task force bill prior to the amendment had received either letters or verbal support from the Minnesota Chiefs of Police Association, as well as others. One of the conditions of the Chiefs of Police Association's endorsement was that the DWI task force's bill did not include a provision regarding forfeiture. And law enforcement made it clear to me that they would not be supportive of any bill that has forfeiture provisions. I don't know if anyone here is here to testify on behalf of law enforcement, but I do want to note that the Minnesota Chiefs of Police Association, at least, would likely withdraw their endorsement of the bill if Section 18 is included. Thank you, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
We'll take your word on it, but we will need to verify that. So, sure. Thank you. Questions for Mr. Bernstein? All right.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Senjum.
I'm just wondering, as you evaluate this 2.20 versus 0.16, did the, and you cite statistics and things like that, but did the committee look at any, you know, physiologic data, motor skills data? I'm waiting at the area I just don't know anything about, but the degree of impairment at 0.16 versus the degree of impairment at 0.20, is that significant from the standpoint of one's ability to perform, so to speak, in a car or anywhere else?
Mr. Bernstein.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Senator Senjum. I'm not familiar with the physiological studies that have been done, but I do know that there have been studies done that have determined that those with an alcohol concentration of 0.15 or above are considered the more dangerous drivers. In fact, the Foundation of Advanced Alcohol Responsibility has defined hardcore drunk drivers as those who drive with a high AC of 0.15 or above. Again, I don't have physiological data or in terms of impairment, but I would imagine that that was a factor that went into this study and the characterization of, quote, hardcore drunk drivers, unquote.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. All right, questions, members? All right, welcome to the committee.
Thank you. My name is Gina Calistro, and I'm a volunteer with Mothers Against Drunk Driving here in Minnesota and a victim survivor of the 100% preventable crime of drunk driving. In its amended form, SF 1073 does not do enough to advance public safety. While there are pieces we support, there are also pieces that we now oppose in this omnibus bill. Important life-saving advancements from both the MAD and DWI task force bills were lost. In addition, bills were added that do not support victims and survivors of impaired driving crashes. In its current state, SF 1073 nibbles around the edges of proven, known effective DWI countermeasures. While the legislature passed an ignition interlock law in 2011, it's a weak law. Offenders can sit out their requirements to install an interlock and drive anyway. It does not address all offenders, and Minnesota has a poor record of offenders ultimately installing interlocks, even when court-ordered. During the period of time since the DWI law was passed, there have been approximately 105,000 DUI arrests and approximately 18,000 participants in the ignition interlock program. The participation rate of slightly less than 18% is an unacceptably low when one considers that 70% of all DUI arrests require the use of an ignition interlock device for legal driving. Minnesota's outdated approach of hoping for the best with license revocation alone is not getting the job done. MAD believes it's time for significant changes in Minnesota's ignition interlock law. Research has shown that there are virtually no differences between DWI offenders and subsequent offenders. First DWI offenders and subsequent offenders. It's a myth that most first offenders simply made a mistake or overindulged this one time. Research has shown that drunk drivers drive at least 80 times before they are ever arrested, which makes sense, when almost two-thirds of drivers involved in fatal alcohol-related crashes have never been arrested for a DWI. 40% of first-time offenders go on to be reinstated for subsequent DWIs. Clearly, they aren't getting the message the first time. With that being said, I would like to share my personal story. April 12th, 2009, Easter Sunday, the day that forever changed my life. the day my parents were struck by a drunk driver. When the day came to an end, my mother hugged me and said, "Gina, this was the best Easter ever." Little did I know, 5 minutes later, our lives would be changed forever. My parents were struck head-on by a drunk driver traveling at 60 miles per hour southbound in a northbound lane. My sister and her young children came upon the crash as they were following not far behind. My parents were both critically injured. My father was transported by ambulance. My mother was airlifted by a helicopter. They never saw each other conscious again. 63 days later, my father, a Vietnam veteran who served on the Minneapolis Police Department for 30 years, succumbed to his injuries. My mother survived but has faced years of therapy around her injuries. But more painful was the heartbreak of losing my father. The drunk driver who hit my parents was a repeat DWI offender who was court-ordered to have had an ignition interlock installed on his vehicle and did not. He was unharmed physically, but must now live forever with the fact that his bad decision to drink and drive took the life of a one-of-a-kind, larger-than-life man who meant the world to many. In the former state of the Mad Bill, the situation of repeat and high BAC offenders continuing to drive without ignition interlock would have been addressed. The way the bill reads now, my family's tragedy could easily become another's family's tragedy. Research is clear that ignition interlocks are just as effective for the first-time offenders as repeat offenders, and ignition interlocks reduce recidivism while interlock is in place an average of 67%. Scores of national peer-reviewed academic studies have proven ignition interlocks' effectiveness and given offenders a way to drive legally while protecting the safety of the motoring public. 24 states have mandatory all-offender laws or significantly incentivized ignition interlocks for all offenders. All-offender locks are supported by MAD, the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration, National Transportation Safety Board, Centers for Disease Control, Advocates for Auto and Highway Safety, American Automobile Association, Auto Alliance, Insurance Institute for Highway Safety, International Association of Chiefs of Police, National Safety Council, and the Foundation of Advancing Alcohol Responsibility, a group funded by the nation's leading distillers, the alcohol industry. We need to send a strong message that drunk driving is unacceptable and those who drive impaired will be held responsible. MAD has been around for 35 years. And let me be clear today, MAD has no problem with people of legal age enjoying adult beverages. And we believe that the majority of people understand that alcohol and driving are a dangerous combination. But there are still people who aren't getting the message. In 2013, alcohol-impaired crashes killed 117 and injured 2,300 sons, daughters, mothers, fathers, husbands, and wives, siblings, cousins, and friends on Minnesota roads. These deaths and injuries were senseless and preventable. Nibbling around the edges of the DWI law, like this bill in its amended form does, will not prevent these tragedies that affect our citizens in every corner of the state. As legislators, you have the power to make significant changes to interlock laws, and your constituents will support this. In November 2013, Zenith Research Group, at the direction of the Minnesota Department of Health, conducted a phone survey of public attitudes of selected alcohol policies. When asked how strongly they would favor or oppose mandatory ignition interlock requirements for all people convicted of driving under the influence of alcohol, 84% of the respondents supported mandatory ignition interlock devices on all vehicles of those convicted on a DUI violation. These kinds of improvement MAD seeks are not radical. As I stated earlier, 24 states have mandatory all-offender interlock laws. MAD believes the administrative changes proposed in our bill, as well as those in the DWI Task Force original bill, will help, but will not significantly change the safety picture in our state. We must send a clear message to those who drive impaired. It's not acceptable. If you drive impaired in Minnesota, there will be consequences. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Calistro. We're sorry on behalf of the committee for your loss, and thank you for having the courage to share your personal story. Questions, members? Senator Westrum, then Senator Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for your personal story and your observations on here. A couple of questions. Your early comments sounded like maybe you didn't like the ignition interlock or thought it was a weak law, but your later comments sounded like it affirmed what. Can you clarify that, and then what are the changes you're suggesting that need to be made so ignition interlock is a better and more viable alternative here in Minnesota?
Ms. Calistro.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Westrum, thank you for that question. Let me be clear. MAD National and MAD Minnesota's position is that we want all offender interlock laws. In our bill, we looked at ways to take steps closer to making sure those who are court-ordered to be on ignition interlocks actually have them installed versus the wait-out period.
Okay. Say that last part again. What is it,
Ms. Plistro?
So those who have a high BAC or
blood alcohol content.
Correct. Or who have had multiple offenses that they're court ordered to be on ignition interlock. But what we know is that 70% of them are not having them installed. They're opting out the wait out period. And we all know in this room today that they're still driving. And we recognize the fact that they need to get to work, need to get to school. And so we, in our original MAD bill, are pushing that it become mandatory for those with the high BAC or multiple offenses to have ignition interlock installed before they can have their driver's license reinstated.
So you're, Senator Mr. Chair, I forgot your last name.
Calistro.
Ooh, I'm not promising I'll get that right the
That's
second
right,
time.
That's right, one does.
So your position would be don't maybe not have the 12-month no license or 90-day no license. Just put them on interlock right away instead of taking away the license, where we're giving them the option of
correct.
One or the other.
Mr. Chairman,
am I understanding you right?
That's correct.
Correct. Okay. Secondly, I guess edification based on this topic and subject, but maybe we're getting closer to this, Mr. Chair and Senator Latz. For several years, I was pushing, and I still think it's a very similar policy to ignition interlock, but we should change our liability laws in Minnesota to allow breathalyzers at bars and establishments like several other states have done. People pay for their own breathalyzer. It's not an absolute science, but it gives you a very strong indication of whether you should find a designated driver if you've had one more beer than you thought. And so I'd be interested in what MAD's position is on that type of policy to enhance our DWI atmosphere and the ability of keeping people out of their cars if they've had too much to drink. Have you thought anything about that? I would like to see us as a state adopt those reforms that would promote our bars and establishments to at least have that as a viable option for customers and patrons. Pontification, but very relevant to this subject. Any observations you guys have, I'd be interested in.
Mr. Chairman,
Ms. Senator
Westrom, in terms of the having the devices in the bars to promote, you know, calling for a designated driver, MAD at this point does not have a position on that, and I unfortunately are not able to speak to that, but we'll take that information back to both our Minnesota public policy group as well as our national group and hopes to provide you some additional information of that.
Okay. I'd appreciate that, Mr. Chairman, and for your information, feel free to let me
Senator
know.
Westrom.
If you have any questions, I know several other states, Washington might be the forefront leader on this in their restaurants and bars.
Thank you, Senator.
Well, Senator Westrom, I do understand it is permissible for a bar to have a device there for people to use. It's their option.
Mr. Chair, it is, but there's liability issues that go along with it, and so many in Minnesota elect not to do it, and vendors don't come into our state because of it. And so it's been a few years since I've looked at the legislation that I've proposed on it, but I raise it because it's a relevant topic, and hopefully members, maybe it'll, the legislature has changed in 5-6 years, and hopefully it would pique enough people's interest that we would relook at that policy. Very, very simple changes that I think could be very helpful statewide.
Thank you. Senator Kiffmeyer.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. And again, appreciate your testimony on the points that you bring up and your story, very hard as that is, but appreciate your doing that. I have a question for Senator Latz. Senator Latz, I think I had kind of a understanding that when you have proof of insurance, proof of all kinds of stuff and things, I think I just thought that proof of installation would have been somewhere, even in the previous bills. And so when I think of the testimony here, I think of proof of install seems like something reasonable. And we do it in so many other areas. It seems like that might be a very welcome addition to this without taking away some of the other goals that you may have. Could you reply to that?
Senator Latz.
Yeah. Mr. Chairman, Senator Kiffmeyer, the department can verify this, but my understanding is they require proof of installation before they will give you a valid license.
with the ignition interlock device.
Ms. Oscars. Department.
Mr. Chair, Senator, yes. The department requires that the manufacturer vendor sends a document to the state stating that there's been an installation before any type of a license is issued, stating that they and putting them into a valid or limited status.
Well, Mr. Chairman, then I'm a little bit, we have a statistic here that 70% of them, though they are ordered, do not. So that seems to be conflicting. Maybe there can be some explanation to clarify that.
Senator Latz.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Kiffmeyer, I think that statistic refers to those who choose to wait out the revocation period rather than enroll in the ignition interlock program. So you've got two options if you're, you commit a qualifying offense. You don't have to. This is one of MAD's proposals, was that you have to go through the ignition interlock program for the minimum period of time before you can get your license reinstated or get valid without the ignition interlock at the end of that program. It was not one of the proposals from the DWI task force. So there is in current law and in the bill as proposed still the option to wait the full year and of revocation, for example, or however long it is, and not drive validly at all. Hopefully not drive at all.
Well, Mr. Chairman, Senator it Kiffmeyer. Seems as though this not driving thing doesn't work too well.
I would agree with that.
And so if that's the case, then I think maybe something else. You know, it isn't so much that I'm opposed to what this is doing, but I do have to say that the testifier and information give a person great concern that maybe indeed we could go further.
All right. All right. Anything further, members? Would anyone else like to testify on Senate File 1073? With that, Senator Newman, would you like to move the bill?
I would. Where is it headed? To the floor?
To the floor. To the floor.
Yeah, I would move that Senate File 1073 as amended be recommended to pass and move to the floor.
All right. Anything further? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, no. Motion carries. Thank you, Senator Latz.
Mr. Chairman, members, thank you so much for your time.
All right. I think Senator Sparks has been waiting patiently. We have someone who's traveled from Brainerd who to testify on Senator Sparks' bill, so we're going to jump to that.
Right-of-way crossings.
All right. So Senator Sparks is here to present Senate File 877. We have a delete all amendment, Senator Sparks.
Yes, Mr. Chair, I believe it's the A3 amendment.
A3. We can pause for a moment and allow that to be passed out. And I see that our bill summary is written to the delete all.
Thank you.
This is an author's amendment because this is the first hearing. We'll wait for that to get passed out. Senator Kent will move the A3 author's delete all amendment. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, no. Motion carries. Senator Sparks.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Senate File 877 is an attempt to address costs charged to utilities wanting to cross under railroads. As our telecommunication providers work to deploy broadband access across the state, it is sometimes necessary to cross these rail lines. When doing so, they have been met with requests for high licensing and insurancing requirements. I know that you have a busy schedule, Mr. Chair and members, so in the interest of time, I'd like to turn over to my testifier to explain the need for this legislation and answer any questions you may have. Mr. Larson's here today, and if it's okay with you, Mr. Chair, I would turn it over to him at this time.
Absolutely. Thank you, Senator Sparks. Welcome, Mr. Larson. Please introduce yourself and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, committee members. My name is Kevin Larson, and I'm the CEO, general manager of CTC, or Consolidated Telecom, based in Brainerd, Minnesota. I want to first thank you for this opportunity to testify on Senate File 877 on behalf of the Minnesota Telecom Alliance membership. CTC is a 65-year-old telecommunications and broadband company with a history of serving areas where no one else will serve. CTC's service area spans nearly 1,000 square miles in north-central Minnesota, serving over 12,000 members with telephone, cable TV, and high-speed broadband services. Over the past 5 years, CTC has invested approximately $50 million in fiber optic infrastructure through approximately 60% of those 1,000 square miles. In 2013 alone, we experienced 9 railroad crossings needed to complete that fiber optic installation. Those 9 crossings resulted in a total additional cost of $31,140 for the railroad licenses and for additional insurance costs that the railroad requires before they let us directionally bore under their railroad property. Under Senate File 877, the railroad crossings would have cost CTC only $6,750 instead of the $31,000. This would have given my company over $24,000 in additional funds, which could have been used to further build out more fiber optics to provide high-speed broadband service. CTC is just one example of this. One other MTA member received a bill for over $30,000 for one single crossing. As we look forward to the 2015 construction season, CTC is extremely concerned by these past potential fees. CTC has plans to build additional fiber optic infrastructure in rural Randall, Minnesota, just north of Little Falls. It is anticipated that we will have anywhere from 20 to 25 railroad crossings to complete this construction. If Senate File 877 is not successful, CTC is looking at an additional cost in excess of $86,000 for those crossings based on past fees. Or we could incur approximately $18,000 if this bill does succeed, which would be a savings of over $67,000. Again, that is money that we would be using to further deploy broadband in rural Minnesota. Keep in mind that there is minimal or no disturbance to any of the railroad rights of way when we use the directional boring method, which in 2013 we used it on all 9 crossings, and we continue to plan to use that method in 2015. I'm here today on behalf of not only CTC and the MTA, but all utilities. You see, this issue just doesn't affect telecommunications, but it also affects gas, water, and electric utilities. And I, myself, having worked a number of years in South Dakota, I took it upon myself to contact the South Dakota Telephone Association to see what they have done over the years and learned that they had passed a similar bill like this one here today. And since then, I have been urging the MTA to propose something similar. I want to thank you, Mr. Chairman, committee members, for this opportunity to share our story of the costs of doing business because of the exorbitant requirements for licenses and insurance to simply directionally bore fiber optics underneath the railroad beds providing broadband service. Another note is whether they are active or not or retired tracks, we have to pay these fees. So, Mr. Chairman, I thank you for the committee's attention, and I'd be happy to stand for questions.
Thank you, Mr. Larson. Questions, members? Senator Newman.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Larson, you've a couple of times indicated that your company would simply bore under the railroad crossing, and that's how you would gain access to cross it. The bill, however, says over, under, or across a railroad right-of-way. And I could easily see a situation where if someone proposed to go over a railroad right-of-way for, say, $750, that might be problematic and quite different from boring. What kind of crossings would be entailed where you're going to go over a railroad bed or across a railroad bed rather than under it?
Well, Mr. Senator, Senator Dibble, Senator Newman, thank you for that question. Obviously, I cannot speak for other utilities, and we're 100% underground in our industry. And I'm not an engineer either, so I really can't speak to that unless I do have other members of the MTA here, unless they have information, but I'm not qualified to speak to that at this time.
Senator Newman, Council did just point out to me that there is a dispute resolution process should there be a concern about a crossing. Council, would you like to describe that briefly?
Mr. Chair and Senator Newman, in current statute, there is a process that the Department of Commerce, that any party can appeal to the Department of Commerce, who holds a hearing and assesses costs and so on when a utility wants to create a crossing. And that process is still remaining in statute. So if this bill were to pass, if the railroad did not approve of some aspect of the proposed crossing, they could still go to Commerce the way they could today.
So, Mr. Chair, what would we accomplish with this bill if that is the case?
Mr. Larson.
It sounds almost, Mr. Chair, like, you know, they get one free ask and then they go to litigation. That's what it sounds like to me. But
so, yeah. Mr. Larson, what problem are we solving that is not already addressed concisely?
Well, first of all, the exorbitant fees that they charge, and as far as we know, very few companies have taken upon themselves. We're usually under the gun to get these projects done, and the fees, what I've learned from other states that have done this is that that has cleaned up the fee structure, and it also speeds up the process of the project. So what you would, in our view, Senator Newman, what you would be fixing here is it would be much more affordable to deal with the railroads on these crossings.
Mr.
Chair, if I may ask Senate Counsel then, would it be correct that in this secondary procedures that you have mentioned, would the railroad still be entitled or able to request the, quote, exorbitant fees?
Council.
Mr. Chair and Senator, as I understand the bill, it sets out a fee of $750. And if the parties choose to utilize this process, they can just, you know, basically reach their own agreement with these sort of standard provisions. But there are also there's subdivision 7 on 3.9 that also allows for a petition to the PUC if there are unresolved issues. So I believe that this offers a way for the parties to move forward without any other governmental process. But there is also the PUC option that's given in the bill.
Okay. Thank you.
All right. Anything else? Anything further, members? Senator Westrum.
Mr. Chair and Senator Sparks, I appreciate you bringing the bill forward, and I'm not somebody that likes to put into law what we need to have companies do, but I have been hearing some of these exorbitant charges, and it's just like what else can be done when railroads by their own rights can railroad the process here. My question, and I want to clarify what I've understood from talking to different folks affected by this in my district and elsewhere, these charges can sometimes be an annual or not just a one-time fee as well. Is that also what you understand?
There has been, on some cases, they've had renewal fees that are very short. We have not. And I believe there, in some cases, there have been renewal fees. And I apologize today. I can't remember if my engineer told me that these are good for 5 years or or not. But there has been rumors that there has been fees, additional fees after the fact. Yes.
Okay. And Mr. General Chair and Senator Sparks and members, I just would like to bring our attention to this. You know, basically they're buying an easement to get under the railroad tracks with a boring sophistication that, you know, probably wasn't around 50 years ago. But compare this to other utility, like electrical lines. When an easement is bought from our landowners, that's a one-time payment. And it's usually the value or less than the value of the land that they're affecting. So if they take an effect 1 acre, they're usually paying the value of that 1 acre, and the owner is still keeping that acre, except they've got a post erected on it. And they can farm it, they can do anything around it. They're paying the diminished value by putting that easement or that power line on. Here, we've got thousands of dollars being charged, and in some cases, every one or 5 years. And so I think the issue needs to be addressed. I'd like to hear from the railroads on what the shortage is that they need to charge $2,500, $5,000, $10,000 for these, but it doesn't seem fair to me. And unfortunately, I do have to run to another meeting. So, but Senator Sparks, I'll help support your bill.
Thank you.
Senator Sparks.
Thank you. Thank you, Senator Weston, for your comments.
All right. So would anyone else like to testify on Senate File 877? See several railroad representatives coming to the table to fulfill Senator Westrom's desire to hear from the railroads. Mr. Sweeney, there's a chair for you right there. Go ahead and take it. You can just pull up a chair from wherever. We can fit four of you up there. It's fine.
I can.
Mr. Sweeney.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, I'm Brian Sweeney with BNSF Railway Company in St. Paul. We oppose this legislation. It's a taking of a property right, inadequate insurance levels, inadequate fees. I would like to point out that we have had a deal in place for a number of years in Minnesota and in other states with the smaller operations, the rural electric cooperatives and so on, where they are charged a one-time fee of $750, which is below our cost of processing an application. The annual payments that Senator Westrom referred to earlier, typically we do a one-time payment. The ones with monthly or annual payments, typically those are older agreements that have been on the books since like the 1950s or 60s. Some of them go back several decades and had those, like, you know, $50 a year renewable or annual payment fees. $750, as I said, is a discount. That's the rate that we have for the smaller operations. Typically, it's $2,100 for a straight crossing for a utility company. There is a cost involved in processing these applications. There has to be a legal review. There has to be an engineering review of the plan. There has to be a field engineering review of what's involved. We have to verify the insurance is in place, and then we have to record these installations on our various company records and maps. These crossings are of no benefit to the railroad. In fact, what they do is they present us with a liability exposure that, of course, we don't want to have. I mentioned that the insurance is inadequate. This is a very real concern. What I see specified in this bill, first of all, would not even insure the utility while installing the installation or while maintaining it, because a general liability policy is not effective within 50 feet of a railroad track. They have to get a special insurance. I heard a reference to the special insurance that they have to buy. Yes, because a general liability insurance policy doesn't cover operations within 50 feet of a railroad track. This was a matter that was in the legislature a couple years ago with an indemnification bill that was passed, and it was noted that an exception had to be made because of the railroad industry and also for Department of Transportation and Met Council projects where they own rail lines, and you couldn't do this work within 50 feet of their track and have the insurance cover it. So this insurance isn't adequate from that aspect. Also, we need to have insurance that covers employee injuries. Our employees are not under workers' comp. They're under what's called the Federal Employers Liability Act, a tort-based system. So we ask that there be an FELA rider on the insurance policy to protect in that area as well. The design, we need to have control of the design requirements. Railroad track is a very different environment from any place else where you're going to build some of these installations. For example, pipelines have to be encased and so on, so we have to have control of those design standards. A question was raised about electrical overheads. We have concerns in many locations where we have had interference from electric lines causing interference with grade crossing signals. Now that we're moving into the federal mandate of positive train control, we have concerns about how these transmission lines could affect that signal system as well. So we have to have control of the design. As I said, we have a deal in place, $750 fee for some of the smaller operations. It's one thing to have that type of fee for them, but to have that type of fee for a for-profit utility that is basically asking to use our property as part of their infrastructure for delivering their product, and they're going to charge and make a profit on it, they should certainly not be covered by any statute that deals with addressing the concerns of the small organizations or individuals. Reference was made to the South Dakota statute. That isn't working out very well. The South Dakota statute, in the last year, the Genesee in Wyoming purchased some track from CP Rail in South Dakota. They announced a fee for their crossings. Rather than take it up with the process in the newly created statute, the same people who passed that bill are trying to negotiate a separate agreement with Genesee and Wyoming rather than use the process that they created. We have a process in Minnesota to deal with disputes. We believe that that is sufficient. There are several concerns that we have, as I said, the fact that it is taking up a property right, the inadequacy of the insurance, and so on. This is a bill that would have severe problems for the rail industry in terms of not only property rights, liability exposure, but perhaps in terms of safety as well. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Sweeney. Questions for Mr. Sweeney members? All right, Mr. Wegner, how are you?
I'm great. Thank you, Senator, Chair, and Committee. Mark Wegner, President, Twin City and Western Railroad Company, a short line railroad out of Glencoe, Minnesota. And this is a very tough issue because our main business is hauling freight. And so when we do have these utilities come about that want to cross, you know, depending on if it's a fiber optic or if it's a water line or if it's a sewer line or if it's, you know, power line, whatever it may be, each one of these things has their own individual characteristics. And in this day and age especially, the whole insurance issue is a sticky one. I wish it was better. I really do. But Brian was exactly right. It's called Railroad Protective Insurance, and basically it's a coverage that will bridge the gap between where a standard insurance would cover and then when you're within 50 feet of the right-of-way. Why do we require that? Well, if there are contractors out there with their equipment, even if we've got somebody keeping an eye on it, what happens if they follow the main line with a bulldozer or something and we hit it? You know, that's the kind of thing. I mean, we hope it never happens, but my attorneys just go nuts over this stuff, and I agree there's got to be a better way to do it. But this bill, I just don't think, does what we're all trying to do, and that's make it a more streamlined process. But we as TC&W, we inherited a lot of crossings when we started, and we do charge an annual fee. It's very nominal, like $100 a year. And basically the reason we do that is so that we have a record of these crossings. We're too small to have massive land-based databases, things like that. And so we need to know where all these crossings are so that, you know, if we're ditching for drainage or something like that, we don't slice up the fiber optic line in the process. So we got to know where this stuff is. And it is a long, cumbersome process. And it, I understand the urgency of your project, you know, and that's usually what happens is people will come to us 60 days before they're breaking ground and we're saying, sorry, we got to go get your insurance, we got to do this, we got to do that. No one likes to hear it, but it's the reality. And so I'm thinking that instead of passing this bill this time, that we ought to have conversations with industry and figure out, is there a better way to do this? I just don't think this is the way to do it.
Questions? Questions for Mr. Wagner. Senator Franzen, and then Senator Jensen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and testifiers. I'm just a little confused. If, I mean, we have railroads all over the place, and if the government, for instance, needs to put infrastructure underneath those, I mean, there is a process in place, I'm assuming. So how can we leverage that existing process? Maybe this bill is completely different. Can you explain to me what the difference is and how you can – I would imagine you would be more willing to work with the government if we have to put in piping or any other sewer or whatnot. I mean, that seems reasonable course of business, that it's reasonable to assume that at one point we're going to intersect with the railroad property. So is there a different process in place for that?
For public utilities,
for public utilities
versus some of these private utilities.
Correct.
Well, it's kind of a we're a small railroad, right? And so we do not want to disturb the communities we go through. So we're not going to, you know, get a pound of flesh for a crossing at a community where we're trying to grow the business in that community. It just doesn't make sense. And so, but as far as the process goes, earlier you heard that the Department of Commerce has there is a process, and sorry that Senator Westrom isn't here to hear it, but there is a process called diminution of value, and I think that was passed in the mid 90s. And so basically if somebody thinks that we're being unreasonably charging for utility, they have the right to go to Commerce and start this process, and then they'll come down and they'll say you're charged too much, end of story.
And Senator Franzen, Council points out to me that the public utilities have the right of domain proceedings. They have a slightly stronger hand in crossing railroad right-of-way. Senator Jensen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Did you say that there are rental things out there that people have been paying since the 60s?
Mr. Chair, Senator,
Mr. Sweeney.
Yes. I mean, there will be... Way back when, people wrote these agreements for $5, $10, $50 a year, and you know, there are a bunch of them out there. I recall when I first started with the railroad, they still had agreements for the hitching rack at the old terminal in some town and so on. These agreements get signed and just never die.
Okay.
All right. Senator Newman. Senator Peterson.
Mr. Chair, just an observation. This reminds me a little bit about a lawsuit that Abraham Lincoln tried, you know, many, many years ago, and he was representing some folks who wanted to build a bridge over a river, and they got in the barge traffic, steamboat traffic, got into an argument with the bridge builders, and Lincoln says, well, the question is, is the right to cross a river as great as the right to go up and down it? And what you're really talking about here is the ability of business to cross a railroad right-of-way where, in all likelihood, the railroad right-of-way was created through eminent domain that we gave to the railroads. So I would urge the railroads to be maybe a little bit more cooperative with private businesses that want to cross that right-of-way. The examples that we were given strike me as being, you know, what you are charging, say, a fiber optic company would be really exorbitant as compared to, say, a pipeline that's carrying something that would be explosive that's going under or over your railroad. But built into this bill, it talks about if there's a serious threat to the operation of the railroad, you have a right to object to the crossing and then go to this subsequent procedure. So I guess what I'm saying is that it seems to me that there is merit to both sides of the issue, and I would really urge you to maybe go back and visit with some of these private companies to encourage them to be able to promote their business also. Because in reality, you know, what they're trying to do is get across your railroad bed, and that's all. So that would be my comment, is just see if you can work with them a little bit more.
Okay. Senator Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Senator Sparks, or I guess members, I think actually my question was probably answered, and that was really my question, is that in my view, these are essentially real estate transactions. And, you know, and if I think back you know, just to a modest sale of a home in the community I serve would be $150,000, and members, the commission on that that pays for everything is over $10,000. And that's essentially, in my mind, what is happening with these, or I guess Mr. Sweeney or Senator Sparks, is that an accurate statement that these are essentially real estate transactions?
Mr. Chair, Senator, yes. I mean, it's conveying an interest in the property.
Yeah. And Mr. Chair and Senator Sparks, and I guess we can imagine if one of these easements is not kept track of and certainly disconnected, we can imagine the response from the utility company and their customers and on down the line being very dissatisfied and unhappy. And so, you know, from my perspective, I'd be inclined not to support this bill at the time and at this time and try and encourage the parties to work together to a certain extent, because I do know the railroads, I mean, from my experience in St. Cloud, you know, do want to be good neighbors and great neighbors. In fact, we just have spent a better part of 3 years negotiating with Burlington Northern and Santa Fe, and I should thank Mr. Sweeney publicly and that organization for selling right-of-way to Stearns County in order to build a bike path, for example, that's going to connect the Lake Wobegon Trail to the heart of the city of St. Cloud, just south of the Crossroads Shopping Mall. And so, you know, it's my experience that the railroad is more than happy to sit down and try and work through these things. I understand it does take time because there's very serious safety concerns that it sounds like we're going to hear about some more later today. But from my perspective, I don't think $750 is enough based on these real estate these transactions and the cost. Quite frankly, the costs are created by our own regulations in terms of what the county is looking for, what the banks are looking for. And quite frankly, it's our own fault with our local municipalities and state government and federal government that create all these regulations that have to be met through engineering requirements and real estate transactions. And so I guess another question I had for you, Mr. Chair, it seems that there's a lot, you mentioned this is the first stop for this bill. You know, it does seem like there's a lot of issues within this bill that certainly include energy environment related to the utilities, as well as insurance. So that would mean the Commerce Committee, and then certainly where we're going to be potentially taking of private lands, you know, that would fall under judiciary. So do you have a sense where this bill is going to go?
I don't know about judiciary or commerce, but Environment and Energy has requested it.
So, Mr. Chair, if I think back, the President of the Senate or Senator Pappas, she has input on where these bills go. Is that right?
Correct. She has input over the initial referral, and then the subsequent referrals are determined either through council advice on committee jurisdiction or at the request of the chair of the particular committee.
So, Mr. Chair, if you're going to send this to environment or energy, you know, for the utility aspect, then it would be up to the chair of that committee or Senator Marty to decide where it would go next?
Kind of. This is okay. A discussion we had earlier this year on another bill. Or the chair of either the respective committee, Judiciary or Commerce, could request it, so they would have a role. So Senator Marty could refer it on his own initiative, or at Senator Sparks' request, or the chair of either committee could, or, you know, if it goes from Environment and Energy to the floor, you can certainly someone can make a Rule 21 motion, and then the Rules Committee will make a determination about its path. Senator Newman will help.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess, hearing those positions, my position hasn't changed. I would encourage members to vote against it just from the sheer fact. And the best example I feel like I can give this committee, in my view, is a simple real estate transaction for a house. Many of those things are the same where they have to be recorded through a closing process that involves the banks and the county recorders, as well as the inspection process. And like I said, on a modest home in the community I serve would be $150,000, and the quote-unquote closing costs would be over $10,000 for that one transaction. I realize it's a smaller piece of land, maybe valued at something less, but still, in my view, that gives us a good example of there is absolute significant cost to these real estate transactions that, in my view, are far greater than $750. So.
Thank you, Senator Peterson. I would actually agree that $750 is a little low. I don't know what the right amount is. Maybe that's something that Senator Sparks can work on if the committee sees fit to pass this bill on to the next committee. Anything further, members? With that, who would like to move Senate File 877? Senator Rest will move Senate File 877 as amended, be recommended to pass. Actually, would anyone else like to testify on 877? As amended, be recommended to pass and referred to the Committee on Energy and the Environment, or Environment and Energy. Questions, members? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, no.
No. No.
Motion carries.
That's division.
Thank all right. You, Mr.
The division has been requested. All in favor of Senator Rest's motion, please raise your hand.
What was the question?
To send it? Favor passing it.
All opposed, please raise your hand. On a vote of 9-5, the motion passes. Thank you, Senator Sparks.
Mr. Chair.
Okay, members, we are in recess until 6.
7?